We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
Go on without me. Just go!
A good soldier never leaves a man behind.
Because I wouldn't give you 2 cents for all your fancy rules if behind them they didn't have a little bit of plain, ordinary, everyday kindness.
Life, finds a way.
Welcome to Silver Screen Biases. Each week we pick a movie off of IMDb's Top 250 and dig into it. We're examining truth claims in critically acclaimed movies while also examining our own biases. I'm Nelson.
This is Jeff.
And this week...
Rat-patootie.
This episode is brought to you by our community on Patreon. They make this show happen and you can help. Links to our Patreon and merchandise are in the show notes. Now back to the show.
Happy Wednesday.
We have with us my best friend who Jeff is meeting for the first time, Sam.
You look lovely.
Why, hello there.
Obi-Wan.
Yeah, that's the line.
Obi-Wan reference.
Yeah.
Welcome, Sam. This has been a long time coming.
It has.
I've said that about a bunch of guests, but like, you've been a part.
We should clarify because I misled the audience. I barely know Sam.
Right. You guys have just had a couple casual nights together. Nelson, Sam and I go way back. A
couple casual one-night stands.
Yeah. Sam, before I let you brag on yourself a little bit, you have been...
Please, Jeff, brag on me.
I have really enjoyed the different adventures you and I have gone on the last seven-ish years?
Yeah, it's been...
Is that about right?
No, not seven. Wait, has it actually been 7 years? It's been a minute.
We ended our improv team in 19 because COVID hit, but we were starting that in about, we were talking about that in about 17.
Yeah.
We
were talking about it about the, like, throughout the year before we started doing stuff. And then we started actually doing stuff throughout 2019.
Yeah.
So we actually started talking and actually really started to get to know each other in 2018, which at this point it was 6 years ago.
Yeah. It's been wonderful. So to catch everyone up, then you and I had an improv troupe for a while.
Yep.
Here locally. And
is there content for that we can link below?
I don't think there is at the moment. No,
I deleted the Instagram.
Like once,
that makes
like,
sense. I'd be embarrassed too.
Once COVID hit, then like just shows, like yeah, shows yeah, yeah, we had no ability to put on shows anymore.
We couldn't rehearse. We didn't have a place to rehearse
basically,
anymore.
Yeah, and the group just kind of
and right now is like 4 years from when the shutdown started.
Yeah,
almost.
Yeah,
today.
Actually, today,
almost
yeah, as of recording. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because even the place we were rehearsing at, they didn't make it much past.
No, yeah, like so they're not even in business
unfortunately,
anymore.
It was a bummer.
They did to small business.
That is true.
So, but you and I have talked coffee. You and I have a podcast idea that maybe eventually we'll see the light of day that I love. It's just chaos, and you're getting ready to go do some cool stuff this summer.
Yeah.
And just but Sam, tell us a little bit about yourself. So, where do you find yourself these days?
Yeah, so these days, I've spent the past about 10 years or so in coffee. Like you said, like we talk coffee all the time. Worked a bunch of years at Starbucks, and worked a bunch of years like at a smaller local coffee shop as well. Just barista working all kinds of stuff, and eventually found myself into the kitchen at this local coffee shop as their primary baker. I grew up baking. I grew up in the kitchen. I love Food Network.
What kind of baking? Dessert or bread?
Dessert breads, like sweet breads.
Okay,
not like straightforward, like lean breads, like regular, like loaves or baguettes or things like that that are very simple breads.
Mm-hmm.
More complex, using like butter and other enrichments and stuff like that to make them more sweet and
okay.
It's
very enlightening.
Indeed.
I love good food.
Yeah.
I can cook. I can keep up with most home cooks. I cannot bake.
Yeah.
My wife is an incredible baker. Mm-hmm. Mostly breads, but she can do desserts as well.
Yeah.
Especially pies. I can't. I can't bake.
One of my favorite things to bake, like in my own time, my own kitchen, is just like simple shortbread. Just like delicious, buttery, melt in your mouth, delicious cookies. It's just the best. So I spent a bunch of years like doing baking professionally there. I do have a degree in pastry arts from Escoffier School and
pastry farts.
He said arts, Nelson.
out in Boulder, Colorado. So yeah, I've
that was a heck of a commute for you.
Yeah, it totally was. You know, just like straight to my computer. It was all online.
So dumb.
The mileage.
You know, Jeff, we invest in the things we care about. What can I say? Yeah. I know my way around a kitchen. I love food involved things. I love the professionalism. I love the art. I love all the stuff that goes into it. So
yeah,
this movie has a very special place in my heart.
Because you're French.
Because I'm French. Uh-huh.
Because he's a rat.
Oui, oui.
You're a rat.
I'm actually just a very small rat standing on the table with these two.
You're 10 rats in a
trench coat. Yeah. That's awesome.
Casually. I'm just casually.
Sam, we have a couple questions we always ask our guests when they come on, and it feels right just to ask you the same ones.
I guess.
So I'm going to do it now. What's your political biases?
All right, political biases. Let's see. I don't quite know how to describe that. I try my best to like not get too involved because I will just get too invested too quickly. And so just for my own well-being, I try to kind of keep my distance to some degree. Like every few months or so, I'll kind of delve more into like what's going on, what's happening, and I'll kind of back out again. So sure. I'm kind of currently in a backed out stage. I do know the gist of like the larger things that are happening, but yeah. I just try not to involve myself too much. I just like for people to not stick their nose in my business.
All right.
And so I guess that kind of like, I think that fits in with a lot of kind I'll of this, the sort of stuff you guys then. Talk about.
we'll just move on.
Yeah, movie. Jeff, stay out of my business. I came on this podcast for you to not talk to me, Jeff. What are you doing?
Okay.
It only seems fair.
Yeah.
Sam, you can sit down. You don't have to stand.
I prefer for people to stay out of my business and to just kind of be able to control my own things and my own self.
Yeah.
And I think everyone should have the right to do that. So that's kind of my place. Wherever that falls, I mean, somewhere in the middle, I guess, but you know.
Liberal, I think, is it?
Libertarian.
It's libertarian, yeah.
About.
I mean, I guess
I'm not
conservative liberal.
That's the seed that blossoms into anarchism.
Yeah. You're a conservative libertarian, democratic.
Democratic socialist.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure whether I could, you know, subscribe to everything in any particular camp.
Sure.
So I try not to like name names just because I know everybody has their whole list of things that they associate with those. So.
The minute you call yourself a libertarian, there's a bunch of people that are going to give you a litmus test.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh, well, you're not a libertarian because you don't agree with this.
Exactly.
Yeah. But if you're like fundamentally, I want to be left alone. Like that's that's American political DNA right there.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. It's good.
Nelson, can you ask Sam what his religious biases are?
Sure. Sam, do you have any religious biases?
Can you tell Jeff? No, I'm
kidding. It's going to be a long time.
Oh, this is going to be tough.
Oh, man. Religious biases. So I grew up in church. I call myself a Christian. I currently attend as well, like this small church here in Worcester. I guess that kind of covers it. Yeah, I call myself Christian, and I subscribe to like the Bible is as holding all truth in it and proclaiming truth. I think sometimes
is that a weekly or a biweekly subscription?
Is it what?
Is it a weekly or a biweekly subscription?
No comment. There you go.
You're killing me, Jess. Yeah.
You don't hear about people subscribing lately. I just didn't.
You know.
No one subscribes to our show.
Speaking of subscriptions.
I just wanted to see.
There's dozens of them. Dozens.
And we love every one of you.
Absolutely. It works. Last but not least, how would you describe yourself when it comes to the big screen? What are your favorite movies?
Firstly, I'll say I'm weirdly not much of a movie person. And
Nelson, this is going to be rough.
I have tried to figure it out. I can't quite figure out why, but for some reason, I just have a really hard time sitting in front of a movie for a whole movie experience. Now, I typically really enjoy it when I do. I just have some weird like mental like disconnect from actually getting myself there. But I typically enjoy movies when I watch them.
Sure. I find with a lot of people that like say that they don't watch movies, they'll watch 3 or 4 episodes of their favorite TV show in a row.
Yeah.
But I can't sit down and watch a whole movie. I'm like, well, that's like less time.
Yeah. It's not so much a time commitment. Yeah, like that's the thing, though. Like, it's not so much a time commitment because I'll sit down and binge watch. Like, I mean, I've got a handful of shows that I'll kind of do on rotation here and there.
What's your favorite show? What, like, you're going to sit down
yeah.
a night by yourself, like, I can sit down and watch whatever I want. What have you been watching lately?
Probably, it's probably going to be a rerun of either New Girl or How I Met Your Mother.
Oh, well, good choices.
One of those two.
Psych?
I love Psych. I actually haven't watched Psych in a ton of years, and man, I miss it.
That's a good show.
I need to go back to that show. I haven't seen that one in a long time.
My wife likes Psych. I've never watched Psych.
Really? Yeah,
you should.
I think you'd really enjoy it.
Pineapples? Something has to do with pineapples?
Yeah, there's a pineapple in every episode.
There is. Do you like Sherlock Holmes, like mystery type, like, you know, deductive reasoning, figuring things out?
I'd rather not say.
Okay, well then it's I'd the rather least. Not say whether you'd like it.
No, yeah, I do like investigative mystery shows. Yeah. And it's a comedy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
so it's very much like a modern comedy rendition of what Sherlock Holmes would have been if they
because he's
made a comedy of it.
He's not psychic. He just has a photogenic memory.
Yeah. His father was a detective and trained him since he was a boy to
recognize. So he's very good.
Yeah.
He's really good.
But he goes out as a psychic.
And he's very silly. You'd love him.
No. Yes. Lindsay loves it and she said I've just never sat down and watched it.
You 100% would.
I do know this about you, and I'd like to pick your brain a little bit about you. Would you have an easier time going to see a theater performance than you would a movie? Like a live?
Potentially, yeah.
You have some experience with theater.
I do. Yeah, yeah.
I'm baiting you, Sam.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, yeah. I do, in fact, have experience with theater. Like you said, like we did some improv together, but like I got into improv sort of toward the end of my sort of community theater, like small time theater career, which I mean, if you want to call it a career, but it lasted a good few years. I started off like as an actor on stage, going into multiple productions, and then kind of got to the point where I was helping to sort of run the community theater I was in. And then kind of, you know, making connections between different ones around the area, kind of hopping around to different ones. Got to the point where I was directing shows and doing some producing and stuff. Again, it's just small local stuff. And then ended up, we got into improv and kind of branched off into that. And then COVID. So I've done some theater. I enjoy theater. I enjoy musical theater. And I really enjoy stories. Like, I love them. I love picking them apart and figuring out what all the little pieces mean and how they all fit together.
Absolutely.
It's great. But I just have a hard time starting a movie. It's not the time commitment. I've got some weird mental block.
Well, that's fair. I appreciate that. Okay.
Yeah. Anything you've seen recently that you really enjoyed?
Let's see. I watched a while back. Oh man, what was it called?
Ratatouille.
Oh yeah, you know that one. No. I guess one of the most recent movies I watched. I think it's North by Northwest.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
South by Southwest is what you're thinking of.
The festival in Texas.
North by Northwest, that's a...
Cary Grant, his name? I believe.
Cary Grant, yes. Yeah. There's the... He gets chased by a plane.
Yeah.
It's... Psycho is another one.
Yeah.
Alfred Hitchcock.
Dwayne Johnson.
Yeah, yes.
And it's on the top 250.
Yeah. Yeah, I watched that one.
So we will eventually cover it, North by Northwest.
And that one was pretty fun. It's kind of like he kind of accidentally stumbles into a whole spy scenario where he's not one, but everybody thinks he is, so he has to play the part.
You haven't seen that one, Nels?
100-year-old movie.
You haven't seen that one?
Not yet, no.
Me neither, yeah.
Yeah. So,
awesome.
But I just know that there's an iconic scene where a plane flying quite low is shooting at him.
Yeah.
Well, today, we're talking about Ratatouille.
Ratatouille.
I'll start playing a little like French horn in the background while you talk if I could, but I can't. So,
is it because you don't have one or because you're unable to play a French horn?
No comment.
That looks like an oboe. So,
you look like an oboe.
This movie came out in 2007, and I'll get to that in a second. This movie is about an hour and 51 minutes, directed by Brad Bird, and IMDb says it's co-directed by Jan Pinkava.
Would you like me to clarify what that's about?
Pinkava. Sure, I guess. That seems relevant.
Jan Pinkava was the original director and writer. He was an animator for Bugs Life, Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc. So he's a great tracker. A Pixar guy, right?
Yeah.
And he wrote this in the early 2000s. They actually basically took the director credit from him and gave it to Bob Peterson. He co-directed and wrote Up. He wrote the Finding Nemo screenplay. He wrote the story for Good Dinosaur, screenplay for Cars 3. And his hands are in most Pixar works. He was fired from this. And then they gave it to Brad Bird, who was the final writer and director, who you'll know from
Incredibles
Iron Giant, Incredibles, Incredibles 2.
He did a Mission Impossible.
Both Iron Giant and Incredibles are in the top 250. Incredibles 2 was. Incredibles is my all-time favorite Pixar. So that's why
of the two Incredibles.
Of all the Pixar. That's why Jan Pinkava is listed as a co-director. So this was his baby, but they didn't let him steer the ship.
Okay. We've recently talked about 2007 quite a bit. Mm-hmm. In 2006, we did a movie recently called, previous episode of The Prestige. That came out in 2006. But for 2007, this is now the fourth movie we've done that's released in 2007.
That's right. And actually, I have a detail on that, too. Go ahead.
Will Be Blood, No Country for Old Men, and now Ratatouille. No, you're going to do that all episode, aren't you?
Do what?
Mm-hmm. What's your note about 2007? He doesn't have a note. He's Googling. What is something I can say about 2007 in movies?
Just typed 2007 after was Google the Great just see what Recession.
That's 6 years after 9/11.
No, what I was going to say is that there is only one more movie in the top 250 that we haven't covered from that year.
And it is?
Like Stars on Earth, which is a foreign film. The original title is Tarzamine Par. But There Will Be Blood, No Country for Old Men, Ratatouille, Into the Wild, we've already done. Mm-hmm. And that's four of the five.
Is that a Canadian film?
Which?
The one you just...
It's entirely possible. Let's find out.
It sounds Canadian.
Oh, wouldn't you know it? It's not.
Oh.
It's from India.
Yeah, so 2007, great year for movies. Man. If you're in there in the 2007s, go watch movies. Nelson, was this movie based on any sort of pre-existing writing, literature, pamphlet before? Like
I previously said, Jan Pinkava invented this story in the early 2000s.
Like in a book form? what are we talking? Talking a PDF?
No.
I believe we're talking about a screenplay.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, this is an original story.
Yeah.
Love the energy tonight, guys. Love it. All right. Some notable cast in this film.
Yeah.
There's one I'm particularly excited to share a fact about, one you probably already have. But other than that, it's a pretty big cast. Mm-hmm. Patton Oswalt.
Yeah.
Oswalt.
As Remy. He's great. He does a lot of bit parts.
And to clarify, none of the voice actors are French.
That's true.
Not the female, none of the male cast. Like
the female, Colette. That's Janine Garofalo.
Yeah, none of them are French. So, and some of them didn't even have French accents.
Yeah.
Something to think about. But Patton Oswalt, he's in everything. Most recently, Patton Oswalt's going to be in the new, which by the time this episode comes out, it's already going to be out, the new Ghostbusters movie. He's in that.
This is currently his only top 250 credit.
Okay. Ian Holm, who plays Skinner, you may know him as Bilbo from Lord of the Rings.
Yes, or
Bilbo Ash from The Hobbit.
In Alien.
Or Bilbo from Return of the King.
Yeah.
Or, no, that's all I got.
All right. He also was Ash in our favorite movie, Alien.
I wasn't going to mention that one.
And he's in a terrific movie with Zach Braff called Garden State.
He's also in Fifth Element, Day After Tomorrow, The Aviator with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah,
he's got a pretty big.
That's the full title of that movie, by the way.
The Aviator with Leonardo DiCaprio. It really is.
Keep going.
Yeah. Speaking of Alien, real quick though, today, as they were recording, they released a new movie for the new trailer for Alien Ice Alien
Romulus.
No, I believe it's called Alien. Something.
Alien the new one.
Alien the new one.
Yeah.
I think, wait, yeah, it's Alien
Romulus. Alien, it's morphin' time.
Alien Romulus, which they said is actually going to, what's the phrase? They're going to rewrite some things. Like, it's not completely changing the canon of the Alienverse, but they are retooling some of the things that have previously been established and changing the history. So probably won't go see that one anytime soon.
That actually reminds me of some feedback we got on our Aliens episode.
Just recently.
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
They said, because it was a direct comment to me, tell your friend Jeff to watch Alien 3, but none after that. Because you had said in Aliens that I think I might go and watch more of the franchise.
They say stop they at said, Alien 3.
Yeah, and there's somebody that loves the franchise.
Okay.
They're like, watch Alien 3, stop there.
Does that include all of the Predator movies?
Probably not.
Okay. Okay. Because, yeah. Anyways, Lou Romano, who plays Alfredo Linguini.
Yeah.
He voices a, he's got a nice animated rap.
Yeah, he's an animator.
But,
Pixar animator.
Voices a lot of animations as well, too. But he plays, he's a character in Cars and also in The Incredibles. None of the notable characters, but like he does have some voice credits there. Here's the one I'm excited about. That I think it's a fun connection to an episode we've done previously.
Can you repeat that sentence? I'm sorry, I coughed all through it.
No. He voices...
punch him in the ovaries.
He's an animator for Pixar, but he voices a bunch of some other characters for Cars or The Incredibles and stuff. None of the notable characters, but he's in those.
Yeah.
The next character I'm excited to talk about, the next actor, is the guy that voices Ego.
Yeah, Anton Ego.
Peter O'Toole.
Is that a name familiar to you, Sam?
Yes. Have we seen Peter O'Toole before?
I know you're an avid listener of that show that you've listened to every single episode, so you'll know.
Oh, yeah.
You'll know exactly who Peter O'Toole was.
I recognize the guy's face from the cast list, but I can't place exactly where I've seen him.
Mostly he does like theater stuff.
Okay.
But he's, as far as screen time, he's famous for Lawrence of Arabia.
He played Lawrence of Arabia. Yeah. And I will say,
a movie that we found to be very dry.
Because of the sand.
Yeah.
His voice though in this movie, like I don't think I realized it when we watched Lawrence of Arabia.
No.
But like he's got a very, he's aged significantly from this movie to that one.
I think he's dead now, isn't he?
Well, there's really no way of knowing. Hold on.
You know who I would have cast instead of Peter O'Toole had it been up to me?
James Earl Jones.
No.
Then no, I don't know.
I'm blanking on his name now.
Samuel Jackson.
No. Princess Bride, he played Dread Pirate Roberts / Wesley.
Oh,
but you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah. He's also in the first Saw movie.
Yeah. He's also a recurring character in Psych, the TV show that we mentioned earlier.
I'm not familiar with that.
You should watch it. You'll love it.
Peter O'Toole died in 2013.
Yeah.
He
had it coming because he was quite old.
Probably. But yeah, I didn't like that movie, and I don't think I appreciated his voice then. But I thought, as a voice actor, I really loved
it. Was phenomenal.
The sound of his voice and his character. I really appreciated his voice acting in this film. And that was, I had that thought before I knew who was voicing the character.
Sure.
I did some of this research I didn't do until after I watched the film.
And considering the fact that Ego comes in so late into the movie, he not just makes an impact, but like every line that he says, it's so well said. Like his inflection is great. The way that he delivers his lines is right on.
Yeah. A couple more cast members here. Brad Garrett.
Mm-hmm.
I know him mostly from Everybody Loves Raymond.
That's right. And the Sprite commercials.
Yes, but he's in a bunch of stuff. Christopher Robin, the live action.
He was Gusteau in this.
Finding Nemo, Finding Dory. He's in one of the live action Ninja Turtle movies. He's in one of the seasons of Fargo.
That's right.
The TV series. He's in Night at the Museums.
He was great in Fargo.
He's in Tangled. He's in A Bug's Life. So he's got in many more that I've not mentioned.
Bug's Life. So he goes way back with Pixar then.
No.
Who was he in Bug's Life?
One of the bugs. You're going to make me look this up. Hold on. I'll find out. Brad Garrett.
I'm trying to place which character in A Bug's Life his voice sort of sounds like.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking too.
All right. Well, I want both of you to guess before I give you the answer. I don't have the
answer. Well, all right. Once you have it up, I want to know, is he a named character or is he like housefly number three?
Okay.
Hold on. I was going to say he could have been one of the houseflies. They have a kind of.
What are the poo poo platter?
Yeah. I'm thinking
Stuart Little 2, Recess. He's in a bunch of stuff. I'm scrolling down here.
Stuart Little 2.
No, he's in Stuart Little 2. Not that he was Stuart Little.
In A Bug's Life, he was Stuart Little 2.
Yeah. No, I'm just going through his rep here. Hold on.
How many Stuart Littles were in A Bug's Life? At least two.
Two.
At least two.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. He's a prominent character.
Is he Francis, the ladybug?
No.
All right. That's my only guess. Sam?
Is he the... walking stick. I can't place his name.
No.
Oh, I see.
He's the dung beetle.
Yeah, I see.
Dim.
Oh.
The big beetle that hides everyone under his big.
Perfect.
Yeah.
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 Such a great voice.
I was going to guess the Hopper, the mean Grasshopper, whatever his name is.
Yeah. No, that's Kevin Spacey.
You're right. Oh, yes.
Kevin Spacey does such a good villain. Yeah. We really should have seen it coming. All right.
two other notable voices. Will Arnett.
Yeah.
Who's got a big...
Arrested Development, yeah. Lego Batman.
And then the Pixar guy, John Ratzenberger.
Yeah, he played a character in this named Mustafa.
Yeah.
He's famous for Cliff Clavin from Cheers. He was in Spirited Away and Star Wars The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
He's also in Gandhi.
But he plays Gandhi.
Benjamin Kingsley.
Oh, that's right.
But
that's
here's right. Here's his Pixar. He was Ham, which is the piggy bank in Toy Story.
You're going chronologically?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was P.T. Flea in A Bug's Life, Yeti the Abominable Snowman in Monsters, Inc. He was the School of Moonfish in Finding Nemo. He's the Underminer in the Incredibles movies. He's Mac the Truck in Cars. Mustafa the Waiter in Ratatouille. He's John the Axiom Passenger in WALL-E. Tom the Construction Worker in Up. Gordon, the Dunbrook Palace guard in Brave. Fritz, the mind worker in the Inside Out movies. Earl, the Velociraptor in The Good Dinosaur. Bill, the crab in Finding Dory. Juan Ortodoncia in Coco. And Fenwick, the Cyclops construction worker in Onward.
Is there a Pixar movie he's not in? Have we talked about this before?
Let's compare with a Pixar list right now.
Because, like, you didn't mention Elementals. You didn't mention the piano one. The guy that plays piano.
Soul.
You didn't mention Soul.
Well, then I guess the answer is no. Well, he is not.
But I'm not saying like. Sometimes like he goes uncredited and it's like a super minor part, but he's in there for continuancy.
Well, let me double check. Continuity paragraph there.
Contingency.
Continuity.
Constantinople.
Oh boy.
Words is hard.
It's possible he's been in everything because it says Ratzenberger has voiced characters in 23 Pixar films. His roles include.
Okay.
So we've got four Toy Story movies, A Bug's Life, two Monsters, Inc. movies, Finding Nemo, both Incredibles, three Cars movies, Ratatouille, WALL-E, Up, Brave, both Inside Out movies, Good Dinosaur, Finding Dory, Coco, and Onward.
Included but are not limited to.
Yeah, so it could be that he's done everything. I know he's kind of like the special one of the special sauce voice actors.
Yeah.
Is he still alive?
Yeah.
At this point, he's like the Easter egg you look for. Like people always look for 76. All the Easter eggs, but like he's definitely one of them.
Yeah, according to Reddit, he's not in Soul. So I don't know. I guess that would take a little bit more research but that's not why we're here.
An actor that I didn't recognize was James Remar or Remar. He plays the character of LaRouche. He was in Oppenheimer. He's in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He's in Django Unchained.
Oh.
He's famous for being in Dexter. That's like what he's really known for.
Is he? It's not the actor that plays Dexter.
No.
It? Okay.
No. But the other movies I mentioned, he's got kind of like bit parts in. And the other thing he's really known for is a movie we discussed last 2 weeks ago, but you were unfamiliar with, The Warriors. Our guest. Who was our guest 2 weeks ago?
Mm-hmm.
Who was our
Joel.
Guest? Joel.
There will be blood.
That was a movie that he really liked, was The Warriors, which I had seen but didn't care for. Also, Janine Garofalo, who is Colette, she's excellent in Wet Hot American Summer, a movie that I think is hilarious and cannot recommend to most people. She's also in...
It's really wet.
That's right. And very hot. And very American. She's also in Mystery Men. Do you remember that one?
She's the invisible guy.
Nope, that's Kel.
It's Kel Mitchell. Yeah.
No,
I've actually never seen the.
Really?
I've never seen it.
Oh, it's one of my favorite.
I've seen movies. So many parts of it that I feel like I could say I've seen it. I'm super familiar with it, but I've never watched it from front to back.
She is the lady who's really great with a bowling ball. That's her power.
Oh yeah.
And the bowling ball is the skull of her dead father.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, that's Janine Garofalo.
On IMDb, this movie is 8.1 out of 10.
Yeah.
It currently sits at 210 on the top 250, so close to the bottom.
Yeah.
This is the lowest ranked Pixar movie, I believe.
Probably, yeah.
Does this movie have history on the top 250?
It debuted at 110 in June 2007 when the movie came out. Jumped to 32 by July of that same year, and it fell at a steady rate until it dropped off in December 2013.
Oh.
It reappeared at 223 in February 2022 when the algorithm was updated. Remember, we talked about this in past episodes.
Kicked a bunch of foreign films.
And it slowly climbed from there to its current position. So it's actually done better since coming back on the top 250. Mm-hmm. But it is at a place where if they were to update the algorithm to undo the changes that pushed out foreign films, it would probably drop off again.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad it didn't get kicked out with the foreign films, being that it's French.
Good point.
So, Rotten Tomatoes, 96% tomato meter. 87% audience. Did this movie have a budget?
Budget of $150 million. That's an estimate. With inflation, just ballpark, what do you think it would cost today to make the same movie?
$20 million. Wait, inflation's the opposite.
Yeah.
You
said it was $150 million?
Yeah, in 2007. This is before the Great Recession and before they printed 80% of the money in circulation a couple years ago.
I have an answer. I'll let you go first.
Say 187.
270.
224 million.
Huh.
Well, 224.5. But
nice.
I overshot. You came closer. You win the prize.
Yeah.
Nice. What's the prize?
Closest without going over? You get the rights to the movie.
All right. I'm down.
This movie has a huge...
We have the authority to do that.
Huge debt that needs repaid.
I got a question that we often skip because I forget to bring it up. Was the name of the movie in the movie?
Oh, not at all. Yes, it was.
Several times.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And they even say Rap-a-tootie.
Rap-a-tootie.
When Alfredo is drunk.
Indeed.
Talking to Skinner.
Yes.
Sick mustache, that guy.
Skinner?
Yeah.
So, initial thoughts.
I've seen this movie maybe less than 5 times.
Okay.
Every time I've enjoyed it. I can't say always. I appreciate when things that are not human are given human qualities. There's just something about it that just like...
You so like Pixar? Anthropomorphism?
Yeah, I like seeing a mouse walk on its 2 feet and watching TV. Like, I don't know, there's just something... It's, I don't know, like I've always liked Tom and Jerry. Like, just like, I don't know, just there's something about amphibious animals.
I don't think there was any amphibious animals.
The rat was in the water for a while. I appreciate it. I think this movie is scenic, not in the way like it's animated, but just like there's iconic landmarks in this whole film. Like, and I think I've never been to Paris, France. I've never even been to Paris, Texas. But
I have been to Paris, Texas.
Have you?
Yeah.
Wow.
Any thoughts?
It's fine.
Okay. So like, I think it's beautiful as far as like just the landmarks and the iconic scenery that's in it. I'm always impressed by the details in Pixar. So like, it's like, that's not something new that I've realized with this movie. Mm-hmm. When it came down to the detail of the pots and pans, like you can see scratches on them. Like the bread had the air, like the air pockets in the bread. Yeah. Like it looked like a fresh piece of bread. Like, they took the time to make the kitchen look like it's been used for years. Like, just like, I appreciate the animation details.
Yeah, they visited several, 3 Michelin star restaurants in Paris before, like, to do the movie.
Yeah.
And then had several, chefs who had more than one highly rated restaurant on retainer to provide advice. And so I hate rats. I can't do them.
That's a weird thing to say.
When I was doing disaster relief, we had rat issues. And one time, we had a shipping container that was rat infested. So we brought in our rat dogs. We had a couple dogs that were really good at ratters. And so the 2 rat dogs and then like 4 of us in steel toe boots, and we closed the doors. And we had the rat dogs root out the rats while we stomped them. And one
That's
friend,
so graphic.
Justin... at one point, he says, "What do I do with them?" And I looked up at him, and he had like 5 of them by the tail.
So you're not talking, you're talking rats, not mice.
Yeah, no.
Rats. You're talking huge.
Yeah, and
I would struggle with that as well.
I said, "Justin, we're killing them," because he had caught like 5 in his
hand. So they were squirming in his hand.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no way.
And I said, "We're killing them." And because he didn't, like, you don't just set them down because then they run away, he just started beating them on the side. And then also the ship that we lived in at the time was rat infested, we didn't store food on it, but there were rats there. And we didn't have air conditioning. So I would sleep out on deck because the deck was steel and it was nice and cold and it was hot in Louisiana. And I'd wake up in the night because things were clawing and scratching and nibbling on me. So I
on
can't,
you.
I can't do rats.
On you. You had rats.
Yeah, I'd wake up.
That would definitely.
So I don't I don't handle rats well.
We're going to change the rating of this show.
When we have mice.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
I have thoughts on
in
that.
In the past, when we've had mice in the house, Jen takes care of them. I can't do it.
Yeah.
Any rodent with a hairless tail, I can't handle it. Possums technically are marsupials. I put them in the same category. But I love like cuisine, not just food, but like really like there's a difference, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I went to culinary school for a year and learned to cook and dropped out because I didn't want to do the second year, which was like restaurant management stuff. I love like quality food. So this movie's always been a complicated one for me because I hate rats. But
watching they studied rats. Just watching rats? Yeah, even still, watching them on the screen bother you? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
In fact, this movie does such a phenomenal job animating these rats, especially the scene like when they're flooding out of the house.
Yeah. When they drop from the ceiling.
When there's a whole horde of them in one place. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can't do it.
It's interesting. I had the same perspective, but for me, it's not the rats. It's the French. And the French fell from the ceiling. No, I
love France, except for all the French. That's the
that would be if that was an issue. I've never dealt with rats before. Mm-hmm. We've had some mice in the house that I don't handle probably the most proper way.
Mm-hmm.
It ends up being like a 7-hour ordeal trying to trap these things because I'm too scared to get close to them. So like I don't like. But it doesn't bother me like when I'm watching stuff on screen. So to have your visceral reaction, like it's not something.
Can I tell you one more bad experience I had with rats?
Sure, it's your show.
This is Jen's favorite story. This is when we were living in Honduras. We lived in the same property, but she lived on top of the hill. I lived at the bottom of the hill, and we were in like the common space, and something ran up the back of her leg. And this common space was like my room was attached to it. And so I was on edge. I walked her up the hill to her room. I walked and there was like at one point some vinyl flapped and I jumped out of my skin because it just puts me on edge for like the next. I went back to my room. I turned off the lights. I heard the rat. I turned on the lights. The rat stops. So I left the light on. I didn't sleep that night. In the morning, I got up. I went to change my clothes. I opened the shirt drawer. And the rat's head pops back. So I immediately left. I went and got our friend Matt, who was doing security that day. I was like, Matt, I have a security issue.
Security breach.
He's like, what is it? I was like, there's a rat in our room, or in my room. And he knew how I felt about rats. So he goes in, and he's like, do you want me to take care of it? I was like, yeah.
I was just telling you.
And he's like, show me where it is. So I point to it, and he's like, would you help me? Like, get it out. And I was like, if it's all the same to you, I'd much prefer that you do it and tell me about it later. And so I watched from outside my room. He pulls out the first drawer. The rat tucks behind and goes into the next drawer. He pulls out the next drawer. It goes all the way down and then shoots across the room. And the whole time he's like trying to hit it with like a hammer. And it hides behind some lumber and he just kicks it against the wall, the lumber against the wall and crushes it. And this thing was like,
oh, that's massive.
It was a huge rat.
Yeah.
I don't handle rats well.
You said that.
Yeah.
Well, have you ever seen the movie Mouse Hunt?
Yeah.
I think that movie's great.
Yeah.
Because of it's just people trying to hunt. I love that. I think that movie's great. It's a childhood movie. Yeah.
And then the mouse invents string cheese.
Yeah. Sam, what's your take on this film?
I love this film. I mean, I thoroughly enjoy like every scene in the kitchen. Like, I found myself like this last time watching through it, trying my best to identify every different ingredient in every different bowl that was just spread around the whole room.
Yeah.
I found
nerd.
Hey man, look,
I'm right there with you.
I found that Gusteau's restaurant loves leeks.
Yes.
Because there's just leeks everywhere.
It is a French restaurant.
That's true.
The French love leeks.
That's true. But like every single dish, they were just throwing handfuls of leeks and everything. And it was, like they're very visually appealing. Like the way that they're cut. So like to animate them, like they look great on screen to use that.
They had to invent new animation techniques for the food.
Really?
Yep.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So in Incredibles, they had invented a new technique to
hair.
The hair was one, but also light reflecting subdermally.
Oh, yeah.
So like they have layers there, and they applied that same thing to the food to make the food look more lifelike.
Yeah.
I thought they did an incredible job.
Yeah.
What?
An incredible job.
Oh,
yeah. it was a nice little tie together.
Now,
lame.
I guess I'll save this for recommendations. I was going to say films that handle food better.
Yeah.
Okay. Films about cuisine better than this.
Mm-hmm.
With your time in the kitchen, Sam, do you find this movie as an accurate representation of a kitchen?
Certain parts of it.
Okay.
And I think the part that I find the most accurate is the sort of struggle that the different chefs have with one another. Primarily, I'm thinking of Colette dealing with Chef Skinner and just like the different kind of arguments and conflicts that happen back there, the different viewpoints on what this job is about.
Sure.
I find
what types of kitchens have you worked in?
Hot kitchens, cold kitchens.
I haven't worked in many like kitchens, like cuisine kitchens.
Okay.
Like I've said, like most of what I've done is baking.
Okay.
But what I understand of it, and like I've got like some chef friends and stuff who I'll talk to sometimes. So like what I hear from them, and my understanding of like my respect for food.
Yeah.
And I very much am keyed into those conversations, and I very much understand what's going on there. And like I've dealt with management enough to know the way that would translate to a kitchen is that feels very accurate.
Yeah. I think they did a really great job of portraying like the interpersonal relationships in professional kitchens.
Yeah.
So my experience in professional kitchens is like I ran a disaster relief kitchen, which is not at all like these. In fact, the biggest mistake I made there running that kitchen was trying to get people to like learn knife skills and tuck their knives under cutting boards. And I approached it like Colette does, except none of the people that I was working with had any interest in like learning knife skills. which I mean, like that's not what they were there for. So like more like I don't fault them for that. Yeah. And then culinary arts, like schooling, which I would have flunked baking if, they didn't have donuts.
Yeah.
They tried me in all kinds of different things in the bakery. I cannot bake, but I can flip a donut. Cause it's really just cooking.
Donuts
is cooking.
Gusteau says anyone can cook.
Anybody can cook, but
we'll
not anybody can bake.
Okay. So we all have food experience. Cause I used to work at Chipotle.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to laugh. I know you're not making a joke.
The top tier
of cuisine. All the things I say that you don't laugh at. When I go, I used to work at Chipotle. You bust up laughing.
No,
that was just a
Jeff.
Fact.
Please share your experience in the kitchen.
That is a legitimate food service experience.
Yeah, it is.
No, I was not comparing myself to the French kitchen.
No,
I've worked in food service where it's not just in the food distribution; it's in the food prep and stuff.
Yeah.
And Chipotle is all made the morning of. Like, it's So you were mentioning knife skills. Like, I had to learn how to handle a butcher's knife.
Yeah.
Well,
the chef's knife.
The chef's knife. Yeah. Not the cleaver, but like,
Because
I had to learn how to cut chicken steak. I had to learn how to grill that stuff. We did our marriage. Like, I learned all that. I enjoyed it while I was there.
Yeah.
The moment I stopped working at Chipotle, the moment it was like, okay, I never want to go to a kitchen again.
Sure.
Now, I never dislike, like, I still eat Chipotle whenever I get the chance. I will stand by Chipotle.
Regardless of what it does to your digestion.
Well, my specific digestion, anything sets that off. So it's not Chipotle's. working on a team when we've all got different sections in the kitchen, someone's on salsa, someone's on marinating, someone's on.
You are line
like,
cooks.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, it's like, I related to some of the stress of going, I need this, I need this, we're short on this.
Yeah.
But like, but not the specific, like, large menu scale
Yeah.
Like, you got chefs cooking seven different things versus, like, I only made beans and tortillas.
Yeah.
Like, sure. So, like, I can't relate to the scale of recipes that you had to know.
I'd say.
But the intensity of, like I've never watched The Bear, but I've watched clips from it. Like, yeah, Bear's I can relate great. More to The Bear.
I've watched all of it, but I've watched some of it.
I relate more to The Bear than I do so Ratatouille so as far as my kitchen experience.
Jumping ahead a bit to recommendations, The Bear is, like, if you want to understand what it's like to work in a kitchen.
Yeah.
That's the show. Yeah, that's the show.
Yeah,
And that really covers.
I felt very seen watching The Bear.
Yeah, but also that covers everything. That covers everything from, like, somewhat lowbrow, approachable, you know, eatery.
Yeah.
All the way to cuisine, high cuisine. Cuisine.
Yeah.
Because that's what the show, like, he transforms the restaurant over the course of the show.
Oh, it's a transformer.
Spoiler. But I would say, like, so a lot of food where you pay for it before you eat it. Okay, which is what I refer to, like, as that's my umbrella definition for fast food. If you pay for it before you eat it.
Okay, okay. I had to walk through. I was like, wait, what's the difference? Oh, yeah,
yeah. Okay. I would say that of
I struggled
that,
with that, Nelson.
Chipotle is, like, the least fast foody of fast food.
Yeah.
Right? But with all of fast food, one thing that they do, because you were talking about how, like, you did beans and tortilla.
Yeah.
Full stop. If you're a line cook at, like, at Denny's even, you need to know how to cook a lot of things well, right? You have to know what you really need to know yourself.
Yeah.
Whereas fast food, one of the ways that they've really fine-tuned the process is that you do one, maybe two things, that's all you do, and you're effectively a robot in that role.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's assembly line cooking.
Yeah.
And it's great for that, right? Like I don't fault it. I like fast food, right? Yeah. So.
I would kind of describe the same thing as, like, going from working at Starbucks to working at, like, a small town coffee shop.
Okay.
Where, like, Starbucks feels very much like automated, like a fast food, like a kind of assembly line style work environment.
Okay.
Where you just have to learn how to do your thing, your one thing, as fast as possible over and over and over and over, and over all day long. Mm. Whereas the other one, you're kind of running the entire shop. So you have to know how to do every different thing and every different stage and maintain
it all.
It's
also expected from the customer standpoint that I'm going to pay more and it's probably going to take longer.
Yeah.
But the quality is going
to
be better.
Yeah,
exactly. You would wish that some of the customers expected it to be... to take longer.
It's not that they are okay with it taking longer, but I think anybody going into a specialty coffee shop compared to a Starbucks, they know it's going to take longer than a Starbucks.
I wouldn't say everyone.
They don't always, but I wish they did.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've had many people come in.
Let's compare average customer.
Yeah, sure.
Right? Would you say the average customer coming into a specialty coffee shop is aware that it's not going to be as fast as, like, a Starbucks coffee?
Because
of course you're going to get your complainers. That's true in any service industry.
I think on average, most do. But at my shop, we also had a huge percentage of regulars who would come through every single day who, like we get to know the majority of our customers by name. And it was a really cool thing to have. Every small coffee shop doesn't have that kind of experience. Yeah. I'm not sure how it was for you, Jeff, because I know you also did coffee for quite a while.
We had regulars, and the regulars were more like, those were the ones that wanted to stay and chat, depending on if we had lines of, like, the rest of the people that would come in. Like, for the people that I wasn't familiar with, I got the impression they're just like, just give me my drink and let me go.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't rude or impatient with me, but they were urgent in the fact that they wanted to get in and go.
Yeah.
And so, like, I felt the pressure from them because they just stared at you versus, like, the some that'll, okay, take your time. I'm going to go look at the beans and stuff and we'll walk off. But if you got the ones that just stand right at the register and just stare at you the whole time and you're like, I'm hurrying. Like, it's like,
I came in once and I was both those people. I stared at you the whole time and had a conversation.
Yeah.
That is true. That's true. So, I think coffee's also. Put coffee different than food.
Yeah. No. Too. No. I think I would there's some similar sort of feelings, and like as the coffee world continues to develop and people keep coming up with these sort of more and more and more higher end coffee shop kind of environments with, like, specialty roasts and specialty ways of using those roasts and all these different things, it becomes more specialized.
Yeah.
I think as it continues to become more specialized, we'll get a wider variety of coffee shops to where eventually, I think in the future, we may end up having similar to the restaurant world where you have kind of multiple tiers of.
Are there Michelin star coffee shops?
I don't believe the Michelin star, like, extends to that kind of thing. I think that that's only restaurants.
The other thing I'd compare between the two shops we worked at, same, is the one you're at, the local one you're at, doesn't have a drive-thru.
That's true.
So everyone that has to get coffee from
your shop, they have to invest in walking inside.
The one I worked at had a window. So the people that were used to going up to the window, like, they, I feel like they had that more of that fast food mentality of like, well, if the window gets a fast, walking up should too. So like, that was also different because like, we having a drive-through window, people just had to like, we got places to go. Yeah. Let's go. Like, and I think that's probably where most of my stressful customers came from, was the window.
Yeah.
And I would work that shift by myself 50% of the time.
Yeah.
I'd be handling both window and bar.
If you've got a window, that got though, stressful. I feel like that's a different expectation. Yeah. Like if
you're
I'm
kind
a
of inviting it to
see that.
Yeah. And that's, I think the business owner.
It can be a different expectation though.
Because that's a business owner shooting themselves in the foot if they want to have a specialty coffee shop and a window.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we can say that because you don't work there anymore.
It's coming from the same source.
Yeah.
Like it can't be the same. It can't be a different expectation. Even if like, it can't be, even if in their mind, it's somewhat tangential.
And we really haven't talked about Ratatouille yet.
Yeah, not yet.
When you are at an establishment, if you choose to go in rather than the window, do you expect priority?
Over the window?
Yeah.
I expect priority depending on where I come in line. Like if I walk in and I see them actively working with somebody and then somebody else pulls up to the window and then like they take their order and then they walk over to me, I just expect for myself to be put in queue in line.
Let's use McDonald's as an example. If like, if they got a full drive through, sometimes if there's a full drive through, I'll just go in instead.
Yeah.
But like most of the time, most establishments I go to, there's a person working at both.
Mm-hmm.
Like you've got the kitchen who's servicing both. Like they're pumping out. And like you've got someone taking the inside register and the window register.
That's
like,
fair.
Like, so I can't remember a time outside of the coffee shop I used to work at where it's normally one person, where one person's doing both.
That's fair. Yeah.
So like most of the time it's one kitchen servicing two outputs.
Yeah.
But
what do you think would be reasonable for a customer entering that coffee shop to expect?
The one I
heard? Yes.
Yeah. Like from the customer standpoint,
we set it up as every other. Well,
okay.
I ran it as every other.
Sure.
The goal is the building was window takes priority.
Okay.
Because the window is probably more urgent
and more efficient.
Right.
Quicker turnover on the dollar.
Yeah.
Also, you don't have to pay like.
And it's
technically
easy,
they're not occupying any space in the building, so they're cheaper
as
a customer.
It's easier to tell people that are also inside that hey, it's easier to body language people like.
So on the one hand, I go in because I don't want to wait in the line. But on the other hand, if I've gone in, that indicates I've actually got less urgency than the person that's in the line.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about Ratatouille.
Right. So I've got one thing talking about the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing I intentionally withheld from my stats.
He gets off on being withholden.
To talk about because I feel like this deserves a kind of a bigger spot than just the end here. This movie's rated G. And I thought it was a little not racy in the sense of like inappropriate, but like for some movies when we've watched and it's PG, I'm like, okay, this could have been G or something. This movie's rated G and Skinner says hell. Like there is kissing. There's the silhouette of a female body. Like we assume she's
clothed. There's a whole window full of dead rats.
Yeah. Like we assume she's clothed, but like there is a silhouette of a female body in one of the windows. Like it's just things that I would have expected it to be PG, but then this is G and I'm like, that's interesting.
So,
I wouldn't mind I don't think there's nothing inappropriate that a young child can watch, but like for just some of those small details, I was like, I would have expected this
to
be G.
Would you be comfortable turning this on for your daughter and walking away?
Absolutely.
Then that's G.
Right. In my eyes, yes. But compared to some other stuff that we've talked about where we're like, this could have been PG and it's G, or this could have been G. Like, it's just interesting. Like,
what do you think should be the line between G and PG? Like, where do you think, like, what kind of content do you think becomes questionable enough that it should be put in the PG category?
So you've in this movie, and this will be some things we talk about. You've got stealing, stealing out of morality or stealing out of survival. You've got one moment of what some people would see as a curse word. You know, the word hell is not going to be in Barney.
But it is in the Bible.
It is. But so is ass. But it's just like there are some words that trigger different reactions. And and hell is one of those ones. Like he wasn't talking about the location. He wasn't talking about theology. He was talking about like, you're going to have a hell of a time. Like he said that phrase, like it was an emotion.
Yeah.
I thought, like, it was a theological conversation. I
he was talking scripture. Talking Dead Sea Scrolls. Like, so just like again, I wasn't offended by it, but I'm also like, that's not something I would expect in a G movie. True. Like,
well, I remember when I was a kid watching a PG movie at a friend's house that had a topless woman in it.
Right. And PG's even...
It was an 80s movie.
PG is even riskier. So, like, I'm just... This just caught me by surprise. Yeah. I just wanted to get your thoughts on it. Because, like...
I'm fine with
like,
G.
This is G. Like,
I'm fine with that.
Okay, I don't
I'm
care
fine if, with it. I mean, it does have some slightly more complex issues than some other G-rated movies would have that it deals with, and some other complex emotions and some different things that people are dealing with that I think... I mean, I'm not saying that requires a higher rating, but I mean, I could see how this might be targeted toward a very slightly older audience than a G would be assuming. But I mean, I'm fine with the rating. I think
G tends to be a little more childish.
Yeah.
And this movie feels like not for inappropriate reasons, but like this movie is very dialogue driven.
Yeah.
Very dry in moments because it is emotion based rather than like action and shooting and driving and car chases. Like, even there's a little bit of high energy moments. Like, it feels like an adult movie in moments because, like, it's you're listening to conversations.
Yeah.
Like, you're watching adult relationships.
I would
relationships
expect it to be PG.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm just fine with it being G.
Yeah.
And I would agree with that. I was just fascinated.
Hashtag
I was like,
me too.
I'm surprised that this is G. Mm-hmm. So, anyways. So, yeah. So, what'd you guys have? What were some.
Should we go chronologically or in order of importance?
If we can do it chronologically, I think that.
Well, I do my notes chronologically. Yeah. I just write down things as the movie.
So let's start your last note and work up.
You're gonna go backwards.
counterculturally.
This is like the first line in the movie. Although each country in the world would like to dispute this fact, we French know the truth. The best food in the world is made in France. The best food in France is made in Paris, and the best food in Paris, some say, is made by Chef Auguste Gusteau. Mm-hmm. So, first thing, is the best food in the world made in France?
I can't answer that. I've never had food from France. Like I don't have an opinion.
Yeah.
I think that different food kind of classifies differently. I mean, I'm sure some of this high French cuisine, some of the best is made in France, but there's lots of other kinds of cuisine that I don't think France is going to get quite right.
Sure.
So I think it's kind of a hard, that's a very wide generality.
Do you know who taught the French cuisine? The Italians.
Really?
That's true. Yes.
Aliens. The Italians taught the French cuisine, and then the French made it a regimented like art form.
Yeah.
Now Michelin, the tire company,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
is from France. And so
wait, are you?
Yeah.
Hold on.
No.
The Michelin stars are connected to the tire company. Mm-hmm.
Jeff, the point he's making has wheels. Just let it roll.
Stop Sam, you are never invited back.
Hey, you know, what can I say?
I'm not even cracking a joke. So I've heard of Michelin stars all the time.
Yeah.
It's the same people that make the tires?
It is.
I just assumed it wasn't.
Yeah. In fact, the connection is more obvious than Guinness with the world records. So with Michelin.
Is he playing me?
No. Michelin.
The world record is also the Guinness beer people.
Yes, that is also the same.
This is a lot of
Guinness connection is just that the Guinness family thought it would be interesting to put together
a document records.
Yeah. Michelin, and this goes like long, long time ago, started putting together travel books. And so that's why the Michelin stars.
Okay. There's logic there.
Yeah. Makes sense.
So one Michelin star means exceptional within the city. Mm. And so if you're in the city or nearby, you should go. Two Michelin stars is exceptional within the country, region, state, whatever is equivalent. So you're within that country, region, state, or nearby, you should go. And then three is exceptional in the world.
Three is?
Yes.
Gusteau's had five.
So because Michelin did not give Pixar permission to use their name.
They changed the rating system.
So the Michelin rating is three.
That's right. And
okay. Okay.
Gusteau is based off of an actual chef from Paris who had three stars.
Bobby Flay.
Ricky Cuisine.
I was going to say Ricky Bobby.
Bobby Flay.
I was going to say Ricky Bobby.
Jean Cuisine.
Bobby Flay. No, who is he based off of?
That's a terrific question. Let me pull that up.
I think I remember that, though. Like, I had forgotten that detail.
I didn't look into that,
but I do remember a while back hearing that, like, it's based off an actual real-life chef.
It makes sense.
It does, yeah.
Well, I'm talking about the Michelin thing, but yeah, the chef thing. Yeah. Like, Yeah, it's just, it's mind blowing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, while he's looking that up, Sam, do you have a favorite food?
I have it here.
Never mind, Sam.
So it's based off of real life chef Bernard Loiseau, who committed suicide after his restaurant, La Côte d'Or, was rumored to be losing a star.
Interesting. And so, it's interesting that hadn't that's even also lost kind a star of yet. How
the, it was like, just like rumored.
The story of Ratatouille begins with the death of Gusteau.
Yeah. Now, in the movie...
Because of stress-related, like...
Well, they never say.
Well, they said he's... They do allude
they imply
to okay.
in fact, due to the stress.
Like he had a heart attack or
Linguini
something.
Linguini says, likely killed my
yeah.
father.
Yeah.
So,
wow, that's dark.
Yeah. So, but Bernard Loiseau, it was rumored that his restaurant was going to lose a star, go from 3 to 2. And for that, he took his own life. The intensity of like haute cuisine,
yeah,
the French for high cuisine.
Yeah.
If you really want to see a movie that really encapsulates that well, there's two that are phenomenal for it. One is, what's the guy's name? Jon Favreau's Chef. Which is
that one was in my mind. Yeah. I assumed you were going to say what that
it's
was
a beautiful
one of
movie.
It's a great yeah. movie.
And then another one, which very, very different in tone, is The Menu, which stars. It actually has John Leguizamo, who's in both Chef and The Menu. And it, I watched that.
It's 2022.
Yeah, recent. I watched it last night for this because it's a high cuisine movie that
it's got
seen
Voldemort
yet.
In it.
Yeah.
Ralph Fiennes
yeah. as the the famous chef in the movie. I don't want to give any spoilers for that movie, but I will say that
I remember when this came out.
That
yeah.
it is,
yeah. I remember seeing trailers for that one.
It's like a dark comedy.
Yeah. Dark comedy. Okay.
I would recommend it. In fact, yeah. before I came here, I told Jen, "Hey, after we put the kids to bed, watch it."
My wife loves Nicholas Holt, and so she would probably yeah. be. She's probably even already seen this.
It's very good.
7.2, so it's not in the top 250, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I'll definitely watch that. Okay, so go back to your question, Nelson.
Yeah. What was my question?
Does France have the best food in the world? Like, I think... I've only... Maybe this is not worth sharing, but just to get my perspective. I've traveled a little bit.
Okay.
I've been to Canada.
Yeah.
I've been to a couple places in America. I've been to the Caribbean. I've been to Brazil.
Yeah.
And I've been to Dominican Republic.
Okay.
So all within.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The North America, the Americas, mm-hmm. up and down the Americas, essentially.
Yeah.
I've had some pretty different foods.
Sure.
And I don't think for just me personally, like I don't think it's right to go, this place has the best food.
Mm-hmm.
I think this place has great food because it's different than this place that has great food, which is different than this place. Like I don't think there should be a place that's the best food ever in the world.
Yeah. Right.
Cause like that's going to, that's good. Cause like that's going to prevent people from going, well, if we've made it to the best food, we don't have to try anything else. Like there's so many places I want to try food from.
There's a handful of things the French are famous for.
Nudes.
One of them is their cuisine. Another one is their absolute arrogance and audacity to claim that they've got the best food in the world.
I will say though that like the whole French like brigade system that happens in a kitchen mm-hmm. did originate from the French.
Yes.
And did originate,
so that didn't come from the Italians.
No.
And that was then something that has really infiltrated all of high cuisine.
Yeah.
Like across the world. So like I will say they're extremely influential in what they've done and what they've established. And like they kind of run through the very basics of that brigade system when mm-hmm. Remy and Gusteau are up on the ceil like on the roof
mm-hmm.
looking down through the skylight and like naming the different people in different positions and where they are.
The fact that so many of those positions, even in America, still get the French name by people that don't speak any French.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chipotle used really the cool. term mise en place. They still do.
Mise en place is...
Is that French?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That is... Okay.
Yeah.
Like, I just knew it wasn't American.
And it literally means put in place, but Americans will say it means everything has a place and everything in its place.
That's exactly how Chipotle describes it.
Yeah, because that's how it's taught.
Yeah. So they use mise en place. And so, what was I going to say? What's your thoughts on... Okay, if we're in this food topic here, like, I'll try everything once.
Yeah.
But there's some things I'll look at and go... That's just, you don't need to do it that way. Like specifically those foods that are like, you're paying like maybe $200 for a plate
mm-hmm.
and it's the size of like one giant marshmallow. Like, it's just a small thing on your plate. Mm-hmm. And they're like, it's this and this and this.
The pretension of it.
Right. Like, like, I'm not going to argue it doesn't taste good. Like, that's not my issue with it. But, like, why is the portion size so small? Like, the more you pay, the smaller it gets. I struggle with that. Like, it's like, it feels like it's more focused on the way it looks versus the taste. I know that's not the case.
Yeah.
But, like, it's all about plate presentation where I'm just like,
you want to know why it's all about, like, plate presentation?
I've had
Sam, you want to get the answer on this one?
I've had some very ugly food that tastes, that's some of my favorite foods ever.
Yeah.
It's like, for me, like, I eat more with the smell and tongue than I do with my eyes.
There's a reason why presentation is so important in cuisine.
Why is that?
Sam, do you know the answer to this one? It's the thing that, like, the chefs will say.
Is it the whole, like you eat with your eyes before you eat your mouth?
That's the thing. Yeah. That's the everything in its place and everything has a place. Yeah. That's the...
It's all about, like, the art of the cuisine itself. So it's like... And the way that they would think about it is almost like that they are presenting a masterpiece before you, which has been handcrafted there right now in time by an artist in the kitchen. And that's effectively like that. That's the kind of prestige that they would go into it having, to where, yes, like, the flavors are going to be great. It's going to be really well balanced. It's going to be very, very well put together. But the fact that it's just a very simple thing that they're presenting to you is supposed to be for the sake of the artistry of it.
And it's also because they want you to know that they care so much about this, that they take every part of it very seriously.
Yes.
Including what does it look like on the plate. The first time that I felt like I want to do this as a job was we were on one of my dad's business trips, and the restaurant hotel was a very nice hotel. And we went and we ate there, and I said to the waiter, I was like 12. I said to the waiter, my compliments to the chef, because I'd seen it in a movie. I thought it was funny. And then the chef came out.
Oh, that's great.
And thanked me. And I was like, I want to do this.
Yeah.
Like, that was my
cool
moment.
That's a
cool origin story.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And I took cooking very seriously from then on. And, like, that's why I went to culinary school. And then it was at culinary school that I realized I do not want to be in a professional kitchen.
Yeah.
Not for me.
There's a whole lot of drama behind the doors.
Yeah. I mean, so I think it was Anthony Bourdain who famously said, if you want to work nights, weekends, never see your family, become an alcoholic and an avid smoker, the restaurant industry is perfect for you.
Yeah.
Right. And he considered a good chef was somebody that could cut off their finger, go to the hospital, have it sewn back on, and come back on within the same workday. Yeah. Right.
I saw that when I worked at Chipotle. Right? Yeah. Not the one that's close to us. It was when I worked at Chipotle.
I see.
Yeah,
so yeah.
It's like, I
talk about playing with your food.
I commented earlier, I don't know if it was before the episode or during, that Everything Everywhere All at Once would come back up. Our guest that night was Steve. Our guest for that episode was Steve, my friend. And he shares with me a deep passion and appreciation for good food.
Yeah.
And he makes good money and has been very generous and treated me to some really nice meals.
Yeah.
But, like, if it's my money, because of what my money is, like, if I'm on a trip, I'm checking the Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives map. Yeah. I'm not checking the Michelin
same here.
Map.
That's exactly what I'm
but
checking.
You're but, like, it's the same thing. Like, this is a curated list of, this is going to be really good food.
Yeah.
You know,
so, and I'd be curious to see.
Steve
what
also guys, checks the Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives.
I'd be curious to see what you guys say about
link
this.
Link below.
I'm not passionate about the cooking part. Like, I do love eating and trying new things.
Sure.
It's so, like, one of my favorite shows is Somebody Feed Phil on Netflix, and it's just I love seeing different cuisines, different countries, and stuff like. So I love it. I'm super into it.
Yeah.
The fanciest restaurant I've ever been to was in Miami, Florida. My brother-in-law, they do very well for themselves. And it was on our last night before my wife and I came back from vacation. He treated us out. And I don't even know if the place had a star, but, like, it was fancy. Like, you paid per item, and it was one of those restaurants where you're buying to fill your meal, you have to buy multiple items.
The level of quality and high-end cuisine before you even get a star is incredible.
Yeah.
It's entirely possible that this place you went as and I'm sure it was phenomenal.
I wonder if I can get the name. Didn't of it. Even have while you're talking, I wonder if I can get the name of it.
Yeah. To get a star is like that's an achievement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was the room, like, obviously we were on the ocean, like, so that was cool. Like, we watched the sunset. The cocktails were phenomenal. I mean, like, you're talking top shelf liquor. Like, everything was done intentional. And then the food, like, the thing I appreciate was, like, well, I mean, I didn't we were blessed that it was treated to us. We didn't, it's like, I don't even know what the paycheck was, but like, I appreciated the details that went into the food, but it wasn't done in this gaudy, pretentious way. Mm-hmm. It was made in a way where like, it's meant for eating and yeah. you don't have to feel bad about destroying it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I was like, so it's high end without the pretentiousness. I'm like, this is my place. Like, it was some of the best. I had sushi for the first time there because yeah. we bought one of their sushi platters. It was amazing. Like, so that for me, that's the highest I've ever ate.
The menu, the movie, The Menu, mm-hmm. lampoons that the small portion things while also indulging it. Like, it's kind of meta in the way that it does it. It does it beautifully. So you're gonna love and hate the way they handle that. We got onto Michelin stars because of the best food in the world is from yeah. France. So the reason, one of the reasons that the French are able to say that mm-hmm. is that there are more Michelin starred restaurants in Paris than like anywhere else in the world. And that's because that's where Michelin is. Right? Yeah. But like you get excellent Michelin starred restaurants, mostly in Europe, mm-hmm. but across the world.
Have you ever been to one? Is there any in America or wherever you've traveled?
I'm not aware that I've ever been to a Michelin star restaurant. Michael Simon is one of the Iron Chefs. You know the show Iron Chef?
The American Iron Chef? Yeah. Okay. I'm yeah. more familiar with the original.
Yeah.
So I don't know any of the American Iron Chefs, except for Bobby Flay.
Michael Simon.
I know he's on
basically, that. Yeah. There was a competition to bring on a new Iron Chef.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And Michael Simon won.
I remember that.
Yeah. And yeah. he's from Cleveland.
Oh,
and he had several restaurants in Cleveland.
That's awesome.
COVID killed him. Not literally, but like shut down a lot of his restaurants.
Several
of his restaurants. Yeah. But Steve has treated me to one of his restaurants, and I don't think it was a Michelin star restaurant, but like it's Michael Simon, so it doesn't matter yeah. if the star's there.
His reputation is kind of exactly. his own star, so
exactly.
to speak.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't think I've ever eaten in a Michelin star restaurant. I would love to someday.
Yeah.
It's not like on a bucket list for me, but it's like if I could pull it off, that'd be great. But yeah. not a bucket list item for me.
Right. I haven't either, but like that would be so cool. Like I really enjoy the pretentiousness to some degree. Like, even though I realize I'm probably not going to be full after this meal, like yeah. I'm just enjoying the fun of it more than expecting yeah. for some kind of like high end meal to necessarily be fully satisfying. I realize there's a whole lot more that goes into it than just a full meal.
Yeah.
So the restaurant in Miami I went to is called Etaru, Etaru. It's a Japanese.
I would have expected to be Cuban food.
Hold on. It's, let's see the exact title here. It's a Japanese bar and grill, but it's not a Michelin.
I want to clarify. Didn't make me think it was Cuban food. The fact that it was in Miami, I was right. like, oh, yeah. Cuban food.
Yeah. So
let's get back to the episode.
Yeah.
Do you, either of you guys have something that you want to cover? Because I got a lot of stuff here.
I do, but I don't want to necessarily like completely steer this in other directions than you guys are. So let's steer feel it free to like interject. Direction. So. Yeah. Since you said that we've been thinking about this for quite a while. So like a while back when we were first talking about doing this, I started kind of noodling on it and I kind of put it on the back burner for a couple of months and then came back to it more recently to kind of, unearth all those notes. I thinking through this, I feel like there's a lot of really interesting, like more philosophical layers to it. Looking at the interaction between the different characters. And I feel like the conclusions I came to is that Remy has his own very specific arc and Linguini has his own very specific arc and they're both going on simultaneously, but they're both interacting with each other's arcs in ways that complement the other's arcs in the times when they're together.
And Colette.
Yeah. Well, and she has a very big part to play as well.
And Ego. Even though he's got less screen time.
And Chef Skinner has a very important part to play as well.
Yeah. They all have great
arcs. I thought the multiple storylines going on at the same time, the multiple character development was massive.
So yeah.
Continue there, yeah.
The first thing that I found was really interesting interacted mostly with Linguini's arc. Now, once I started kind of watching through the movie again and taking my own notes on it, Remy's arc kind of takes a little bit of a different path, which I find fascinating. But Linguini's arc I found cool because the very first thing I thought of when I was trying to look deeper into this plot is the fact that you've got a person who kind of doesn't have a whole lot going on for him, and you've got some other force that's controlling him and pushing him around, and he has to learn how to come to terms with that. The first thing that came to mind for me was the concept of the id, the superego, and the ego. And that's obviously comes directly from the fact, like, okay, well, I wonder why this whole climactic moment at the end of the movie, they have to serve a guy named Ego. I wonder if that's a very direct relation to what's going on in the story. So looking at that more, it sounds, looking at the illustration of Linguini and Remy sounds a whole lot like, what's his name? Freud. Sigmund Freud's illustration of the carriage and the way that he describes the id and the superego and the ego, which is the way the illustration goes, is effectively that there's a horse-drawn carriage and there's a rider and then there's a passenger, there's a driver and there's a passenger. The horse that's pulling the cart is effectively the id, or effectively like the animalistic driving force that's just goes on instinct and just does whatever it wants to do based on its
lizard brain.
Yeah, exactly. Very much lizard brain. And then the ego is effectively the person who's in charge of corralling that and directing it in some particular way. Mm-hmm. And the superego is effectively like the passenger who's talking over your shoulder, telling you instructions on which way to go and how to lead this thing. So you've got kind of like the angel and the devil on your shoulder, so to speak, where you've got sort of these different forces pulling you around. It's a literal illustration. That was kind of where my thought process started.
Yeah.
Of literally, he's being controlled by an animal that's literally like an animal force that's pushing him around. And their ultimate climactic event is they have to serve Ego and he has to be pacified. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of where my thought process started. And I've got a more in-depth breakdown of that. But what do you guys think of that?
I think that's really good. I saw a different naked symbolism of Ego.
Okay.
Which I think is really put on display with like his speech at the end.
Yeah.
Where he says, in many ways, the work of a critic is easy. We risk very little yet enjoy a position over those who offer up their work and their selves to our judgment. We thrive on negative criticism, which is fun to write and to read. But the bitter truth we critics must face is that in the grand scheme of things, the average piece of junk is probably more meaningful than our criticism designating it so. But there are times when a critic truly risks something, and that is in the discovery and defense of the new. The world is often unkind to new talent, new creations. The new needs friends. Mm-hmm. And this is less Freud's understanding of ego, superego, and it.
Yeah.
And more like the colloquial. Thank you.
Yeah.
Use of ego.
Cloaca? Yeah.
Yes, the cloaca use of the word ego, where it's like self-importance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he is now realizing that I contribute very little to this.
Yeah.
Right. I'm just the guy complaining, right? Yeah. And putting his own ego aside. Right. Yeah. So that's where I saw there. But I do see the id, ego, super ego.
Yeah. And who knows whether that's actually an attempt by the writer to try to illustrate that.
Yeah.
Or if it was just a concept that seemed to come to light because it's a very common and very broad and very general concept.
We're now getting into almost a meta conversation because we were commenting on how high cuisine can be very cerebral, almost annoyingly so.
Yeah.
And maybe the movie is not near as complicated as we're giving it the credit to be. But I think that those layers are like Pixar specifically tends to do much more cerebral children's movies than most children's movies.
Yeah.
I didn't pick up any of those specific comparisons or symbolism and stuff, but Ego for me was one of those characters that I rewatched this yesterday, but like knowing what was going to happen as the outcome of the movie was that like I was trying to, besides Skinner, I'm pretty much rooting for everyone in this film.
Yeah.
Like there's no one really in this movie I dislike.
Yeah.
Besides Skinner. So Ego, like, and especially going into this viewing, like, I liked Ego knowing how he turns out.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that's why my perspective this time was like, I'm pro Ego.
Yeah.
But like, so at the same time, like, when you're doing stuff at such a high scale, I think you're asking to be judged.
Yeah.
Okay. So on one side of the coin, Ego's not in the wrong by being super critical about these different places.
No, it's his job.
Right. Yeah. And by people raising this bar so high and looking for status.
Sure.
To have status, you have to have people creating status and creating ranks.
Yeah, that's fair.
So at no time did I see Ego as the villain or as someone who had this ulterior motive to destroy Gusto's.
Yeah.
But what he wanted
he wanted
his goal was to keep his declaration justified.
Sure.
And now someone came out and went, nope. Yeah. He goes wrong.
I mean, at one point he said, did they finally go out of business? Right. Right. Like, he wants to sink the ship. Right.
So as much as I don't like, or I can't understand fine cuisine, I understand critics in this genre. Yeah. But it's the critics that are like yelping of local diner.
Yeah.
I'm just like, really?
Stop. Okay. Here's a question. Like for your,
ego trip
take. Yeah. Sure. Do you feel like Ego himself had an arc in this movie, even though he's only in it for a very little bit?
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So
his arc was like,
it was short,
comprised
but it was very
of two
meaningful.
Scenes.
Yeah.
But like he did have a transformation.
Yeah. So where do you think he started in an unhealthy place? Because clearly, in order for somebody to get to a healthier place, like you said, you appreciate him mostly at the end.
Yeah.
How was he unhealthy in that criticism?
His unhealth wasn't his job. His unhealth was his view of his power.
Yeah. He ended up taking himself far too seriously.
To give or take life to different restaurants.
Yeah.
Can I
give a... That's where he... Absolutely, yeah.
So, you and I, we scoff a lot at film critics.
Yes, we do.
Right? We prefer the audience rating to the film... To the critic rating.
Yeah. This is, I like where you're going with this.
There is a critic now dead, we've quoted before, famous.
Houdini.
For his ability to judge a movie based on
Ebert?
What it's. Yeah, Roger Ebert.
Roger Ebert, yeah.
He could approach a Sundance Film Festival auteur film and judge it on that level. But he could also watch a dumb action flick and judge it on that level, right? Mm-hmm. And I think a good film critic is able to say, hey, what's this movie intending to do and does it do it well?
Yeah.
Who's this for and does it do it well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing for food, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that if Anton Ego were to step into a Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives restaurant, he'd be, like, his criticism isn't useful there.
Right.
Yeah.
And assuming he had that power to code switch personally and go, and to change his standards, like what you're describing, like if he went in expecting a five-star...
Sure.
Or whatever, you know, it was a mission star, but five-star power.
Three-star.
But he went to a Diner's Drive-In dive.
Yeah.
And he was still, like, if he couldn't change his expectations on location, then that's on him.
That's true.
That's not on, like, if he gives a bad review because he's expecting five-star versus local diner, that's on him, not on the diner.
So I would say, like...
And that's a lot of power.
I would say at the beginning of the movie, he's a person who... His criticism has so much weight, and he's aware of that weight, and he likes the fact that he has that much power.
Yeah.
And he wields that power ruthlessly.
Yeah.
And with, as he says in his own, it's fun to write and fun to read, right?
Yeah.
So, like, he enjoys being ruthless.
He knows there's an entertainment part to it.
Yeah.
He's you see his billboard in his office? Like, did you pause it and just like glance at some of the headlines? Because they're
I did not read the headlines, but
his brutal takedowns of restaurants
and
all over the place.
And you guys probably picked up on this. His room, when they is the shape of a coffin.
Yeah.
His typewriter has a skull. Like,
I love
that. It's like,
skull.
Yeah, I noticed they give him this idea that he's essentially the crypt keeper. Like, he brings death.
Yeah.
Like,
there's a whole lot of illustration they put into that to make you instantly know who he is.
Yeah.
That's great.
And so I would say that his character arc in this, and really exemplified by having peasant food served to him, which is ratatouille, the dish is, as they say in the movie, it's peasant food. Actually, most famous French dishes are peasant food, but specifically ratatouille is, it brings him back to his childhood, and he's like, food. And this movie does a lot of interesting conversations about food, right? Because the Remy's father says, food is fuel.
Yeah.
And the movie absolutely does not indulge that view of food.
Yeah.
In fact, within that that single conversation, they mock the idea where he says, food is fuel, and if you don't fill the tank, the engine starves.
Yeah.
So shut up and eat your garbage.
Yeah.
Now, anybody that has a vehicle knows you can't put just anything in the tank. Mm-hmm. Right? You have to put in quality fuel.
I took this... So. We may kind of go on a different topic here, but like
there's a lot of topics to go on.
This aspect here, like there was multiple aspects within Remy, his dad, Skinner, like all these different characters, they represent different classes. So like in my opinion, like there is outside
classes of classes in what way?
Economic classes.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. It's like, it's different perspectives on food. So I grew up, and I've talked about this before, like my parents aren't wealthy.
Yeah.
Like, so I grew up with our means to survive, and yeah, and we lived
yeah,
nicely, but we were not the belle of the ball.
Yeah.
So a remarkable
amount of like high cuisine chefs
yeah,
come out of poverty.
Yeah. Like, but what I'm saying is like,
that's more of a side note.
Yeah. I grew up eating what I would probably refer to as not great fuel for my tank.
Yeah, sure.
A lot of freezer meals.
Affordable fuel for the tank.
Processed foods.
Yeah.
Microwavables. like,
microplastics.
And for us, like, we scoffed at those fancy restaurants. And like, and growing up, like, fancy restaurants, and that maybe where some of my perspective of these fancy meals are, yeah, is like, why do that? Like, food is meant to sustain and give life. Mm-hmm. Like, this should be in a museum, not eight. It's like
it should be in a museum.
So you've got the mice that are just trying to survive. They're yeah, the right, bottom rats. Class. They are rats. Rats. You've got rats who literally yeah, live in dumps.
Yeah.
And they're just trying to survive.
Yeah.
Then you've got these people who have these $500 yeah, plates of food. I'm throwing a number
way
out
more
there.
Than 500.
Yeah.
And it's two bites.
Yeah.
And they're like, we take time to make this, and yeah, we're going to judge it. We're going to critique it.
Yeah.
We're going to put our careers on it.
Yeah.
And you've got people going, oh, we're going to eat it. I don't know what it tastes like, but it puts like,
yeah,
it's like you see two different
yeah,
classes
yeah,
of economy.
Yeah, they're two far extremes.
And two perspectives on food.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not just the style of food, just on eating and surviving.
Do you think that both those extremes are both wrong?
No.
Which do you think one is wrong?
No.
What are your thoughts on those two extremes?
So if you're at the level economic wise where your goal is just to survive,
mm-hmm,
feed your family,
yeah,
get to the next day,
yeah,
not create more problems than what you're already trying to get through. If that's your thing, then eating what's accessible
mm-hmm,
is logical and
yeah,
is understandable. So what my parents did, like there's five of us kids. So like, mm-hmm, it's like no one, like there was no yeah, wrongdoing in my family. Just there was a lot yeah, of us feed. So we ate junk.
Yeah.
But so the opposite of that is if you have the means.
Yeah.
If you have the ability to do something yeah, the best,
yeah,
most creative, yeah, the most intense, the most passion yeah, forward yeah, way,
yeah,
then why not?
Yeah.
Absolutely do it. Put yeah, your heart into it. Use your resources to yeah, the best of the ability
yeah,
and make the best thing possible. Yeah. So I also yeah, think that's great. God has gifted us the ability to be creative
yeah,
and to do good, big things. And so if you have the resources and you're not hurting anyone by taking resources from someone else,
yeah,
which, I mean, I guess there could be a debate there that
yeah,
maybe so I think both are right because both are using their means of survival to move forward
in their world.
Yeah. And, yeah, and those three star yeah, Michelin chefs, like, they're doing what they do, yeah, not only because they love food, but like
yeah,
it's their job and they get a paycheck.
Yeah.
And their paycheck depends on how well their food is.
Yeah.
So they're still doing an act of survival, but with different means.
Yeah.
I think both representations of classes are
yeah,
in the right. Mm-hmm. Just they come from different statistics. Nelson, rebuttal?
I couldn't find the term for this, and I was looking it up while you were talking. I think all of what you said is actually very good observation.
Thank you. Thanks, that feels good.
So there's this thing, and I think the Met Gala is probably the biggest example of this. Fashion particularly does it, but the Met Gala is like the biggest one, where like these incredibly wealthy people mm-hmm, will wear these outlandish costumes yeah, that it's high fashion.
The Capitol.
And Hunger Games, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's I've not read the Hunger Games.
Have you seen the movies?
I think I watched one of them.
Okay.
So it might touch on this. I don't think it does. But there's this concept where the fabulously wealthy will do these outlandish things. And to them, it's kind of like an inside joke.
Yeah.
Because then the lower and middle class might replicate it, not knowing that this is actually a joke.
Yeah.
And so the lower middle class replicates it sincerely, and the upper class laughs.
Yeah.
With high cuisine, so there's a show on Netflix called Chef's Table.
Which is, okay, I'm thinking of something else. Continue. Sorry.
And Chef's Table is a documentary style show where they will, each episode is like a deep dive on a high cuisine chef.
Mm-hmm.
Their methods.
Each episode is a different chef?
Yeah.
Ooh, I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
Chef's Table, okay.
But And then when you watch The Menu, they'll actually reference it and mock it. There is a level of high cuisine, though, where they're like, they're trying to make these allegories and like artistic expression like satirical? With food. It's not clear whether they're sincere.
Yeah.
Or whether they're mocking you because you don't get it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
With food, I don't think it's gotten there.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that they are smelling their own farts on this. Mm-hmm. Really, really, really high cuisine where they're trying to tell a story with food. I think they're missing the point. Mm-hmm. I think that the highest expression of food is incredible food. Mm-hmm. That, and that's it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be more than that. Mm-hmm. But I'm also like middle class.
Yeah.
I would rather to defend the single bite things, I would rather a single bite of something incredible than a full meal of something average. And that's why that happens.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because that single bite is expensive. Yeah. Right? It takes so much effort and energy.
Lots of time.
And the caliber of people to make that are very expensive. All that stuff.
Right.
And so that's why that happens. But there is the caliber above that, which is like they're trying to tell a story and it's artistic expression and all that. And their gastronomy, right, is the term for it. And that
I saw a gastronomist when I got my colonoscopy.
Yeah. Molecular gastronomy is like a big thing in the early 2000s in food. I think it's died down a bit. But basically where they try to change... Actually, so you'll see it in the menu, so it's a bit of a spoiler. But basically, they've got this special tool where they can aerosolize and turn milk into snow, basically.
Okay.
And he does that to tell a story. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, either the food is good or it's not.
Yeah.
Now, if turning the milk into snow makes the meal better because it tastes better.
Yeah.
Great. Or aids the presentation but doesn't change the flavor profile. Also mm-hmm. great. Mm-hmm. Food doesn't need to tell a story. And so that's where I have that issue, right? I don't mind the single bite that's expensive if it's if it's exceptional.
Yeah.
I don't want my food to tell me a story though. Like,
yeah.
Right. Another big thing in the food movement in high cuisine is farm to table, which we're actually seeing trickle down to middle class accessible foods.
Yes.
And I think that's phenomenal.
It's a great model. Yeah.
I think it's phenomenal because it's grown sustainable agriculture in huge ways. Which
tables have also benefited from too.
The farms and tables.
Yeah, tables are really loving this.
What's his name?
10 out of 10 tables recommend.
There's a chef out of New York who works with the
Bobby Flay.
No.
I think he's the only chef I know.
I can't think of his name, Dan something. Anyway, he's a chef in New York, and he's like one of the big like leaders and innovators in the farm to table movement. And he's done a few different TED Talks. He works with the Rockefeller Foundation. The Rockefeller family, like the family farm has been retrofitted just to supply his tables. Hmm. And it's like, you're spending $1,000
farm to table.
Yeah.
And it's been really good for sustainable agriculture, and it's important stuff,
right.
But it's also like, I don't want to spend $1,000 and you give me a radish with olive oil and salt. Mm-hmm. I don't care how close I am to where that radish grew.
Yeah.
I've paid too much for this as food.
You're sitting on the hole that radish came out.
Yeah.
I hope that was applicable to what you were saying.
No, to push back just a little bit.
That is kind of like
bit,
the classism there in cuisine.
I agree with, I would probably even say 100% of what you're saying. Like the whole story thing for me, they're like, and maybe it's just because my wife and I, we're currently going through Somebody Feed Phil right now on Netflix. We just watched the new season and we repeat back. We're actually going to go, we get to go see him live next month. I'm super stoked for us. I think
we go see Somebody Feed Phil live.
He's
spoon feeding on stage. Sorry, go on. We're listening. We care very much about.
We didn't pay enough to be able to actually feed him, so we just watched.
Yeah. You don't watch somebody else. Yeah,
we're watching somebody else. No, like he's doing a stage presentation of talking about stories of all the travels he's done and stuff. So
that's cool.
Very excited to go see him. So I'm currently watching this series, and the whole story part for me is the one where I'm kind of like, I kind of don't mind it. Like, so for me, like, not that. the intentional meal tells a story, but like, I do think something that comes from someone else's time and love and effort, mm-hmm. whether they mean to or not, it tells something.
Yeah.
Like it, even if it's just meant to be consumed, like,
yeah.
like there's stories involved. There's a recipe. There's like, again, not everything, not the freezing meal from the fridge, but these places, these countries, these small places, these big places that Phil Rosenthal visits,
sure.
he's talking to these cooks and he's going, yeah, like the reason I do this is because like, even if this story's not being told when the meal's being delivered, every meal comes with a history.
Yes.
And like,
yes.
and like, yeah. and I love this. Like, and especially like in the different countries, like, oh, there's fruits in this location that don't come across
anywhere else.
Like,
yeah. And can't be shipped.
I yeah. love seeing this. Like, it's not so much that, like, I think there is a story that comes with yeah. food. Not all the stories need to be shared.
So let me modify. I looked, I found the name of the guy, Dan Barber. He,
the hairstylist.
He's actually the reason I got into, he's the reason that I moved from being so interested in high cuisine to being so interested in regenerative agriculture okay. and wanting to homestead.
Dan Barber. Okay.
Dan Barber. He did two TED Talks. One was about foie gras.
Does he have a book? I wonder
if he might. But I've linked his TED Talks below. One's about foie gras and one's about, shrimp. Okay. And the foie gras one was about this guy in Spain who has an olive grove. But what he really wants to do is make foie gras. And France has decided what you do isn't foie gras because he's not force feeding his geese.
Okay.
The geese are all eating whatever they want.
Yeah.
And they happen to be making the world's best foie gras.
Yeah.
Now, that's a really interesting story. Mm-hmm. I'd love to read that in the menu. I don't need the waiter to tell me that. I don't need it to be part of my dining yeah. experience. I've watched the TED Talk a bunch of times.
Right.
Right. Yeah. That's what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the storytelling can definitely go too far. I think that like in that example you just gave, that mm-hmm. would be taken too far to where it doesn't actually directly relate to the food you're eating.
Right.
When the story does relate to the food you're eating, like I know there's tons of like family tradition recipes in various restaurants, whether it's like a special sauce
sure.
or a special braising recipe yeah. for a piece of meat or something like that, like a special process that they use or whatever. And having that be in the menu does in fact like highlight the ingredient, or it highlights the recipe. It highlights the actual food you're eating, so that you actually are paying more attention to it and therefore enjoying it more. So I think the story that's being told has to be one which is actually enhancing your experience,
yeah.
not one which is just completely aside from your experience, but is cool. I think it, in order for it to be effective, it has to right. directly affect what you're eating
right.
and make you feel better about what you're eating. And sometimes the stories about like ethically sourced ingredients and things like that can help the right people feel yeah. better about what they're eating, but some people just don't care.
Right.
Sure. And so
that's kind of acceptable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
If I'm like, just here for a meal, that also right. is
the
fine.
The main yeah, goal exactly. of going to any place that's providing food
yeah,
is to consume food.
Yeah.
The experience, the aesthetic is second.
Yes. Yeah.
Now it can be a very close second. It can be 1.5 even, mm-hmm. but like if you're going to a place that has food, mm-hmm. the goal is to consume the food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you think, to bring this back to bring a little more back to Ratatouille, do you think that since we were talking originally about Remy's dad
mm-hmm.
and his view on food, about just shove whatever you can get in your mouth and food you'll be fine. Just deal with your lot in life and just keep on plotting. There's nowhere else for you to go. Do you think that that kind of restriction that he automatically puts on Remy with those kinds of statements, do you think that that is him taking it too far the other direction to say, you know what, don't care about the story, don't care about the cuisine, don't care about the art, just shove it in your face and shut up? Do you think that that's him taking it too far? And what do you think his deal is? Like, where do you think he's coming from in saying those kinds of things? And how do you think that affects Remy?
So,
I know that was a bunch of questions.
No. Whereas Skinner is just a jerk.
Yeah.
I don't think Remy's dad is trying to do anything but provide for his son.
Okay.
But I think he gets frustrated that his son is not alike the mm-hmm. rest of the other 100,000 rats mm-hmm. that are in their colony or whatever.
Yeah.
It's sure. like, so I think the frustration comes from the fact that like the group mentality, mob mentality, like everyone else is literally yeah. never griped or complained about food. And like, you're doing this when we have all of this, when we have what we've always done. Like, it's like, Remy's dad's not at a fault for mm-hmm. having that mindset of this is how we survive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
where I do think he falls is and we're talking about rats here, but like where he doesn't allow his son to be an individual.
Well, we're talking about rats, but we're also talking about people because they personify the rats.
Right.
This is actually like, just a story about people, but they're just using rats as part of the illustration.
Yeah, Remy's dad's fault is when he doesn't allow his son to be an individual and he expects his son to do the thing everyone else does.
Yeah.
And if you veer from that and you're wrong and like, you got a special talent. You have a very special nose. Yeah. You can smell things. You can taste things. Okay, yeah. You're going to use it so we know we don't get poisoned. Yeah. That's it. Don't use it for anything else.
Ultimately, conformity is the word that I came
stamp
to.
Stamp down your ability and just do it to benefit our colony, no one else. That's where the fault lies.
So I would say that the father is well-intentioned but wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Well-intentioned but mistaken. I don't think that his approach to food is wrong. Right? As much as I love excellent food, I also love a corn dog. My wife's Guatemalan. I love authentic Latin food. Mm-hmm. Also love chimichangas, and there's nothing authentic about it. I like Taco Bell.
I was gonna say, you can smash Taco Bell, man. Yeah, it's
so I, you know, our friend Connor, right? He understands high end beer, mm-hmm. but he also likes Miller Lite, yeah. right? You can be everything to everyone. You can be the Roger Ebert mm-hmm. of whatever your thing is. I think the father saying, you know, I eat whatever and that's fine. That's fine. Mm-hmm. If that's what you want from your food.
Yeah. Do you think that he enjoys his food?
No. Nope.
So I
don't think it's important to him. No. It's survival.
So I would say that like that the main difference with your illustration then is that you like a corn dog. He wouldn't care.
Like a corn dog.
Just so long as it's something edible or somewhat edible. I mean, Emil was eating a wrapper.
Right. He doesn't like, see food.
Just so long as it's somewhat edible.
He doesn't see food as anything.
No.
Except a means to the next step.
He's just functioning on the next day, the next meal, the next
survival. He doesn't care what it is, what it tastes like. He's consuming it without even any more thought into it.
And then as far as like the don't go in the kitchen, don't go near humans, mm-hmm. here's how you can serve the colony. Like all of that, I think, within the context of what the father knows, is good parenting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to contextualize it.
Right.
Yeah.
And within that context, he's excellent dad.
Yeah. Yeah. Humans are
dangerous to rats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like
he genuinely is doing
the best
he can. Makes
that point very well by showing him the dead rats in the store window.
And they literally got shot at with a shotgun.
Yeah.
We need to be getting to wrap up here before too long.
Okay.
I got so much to talk to.
It's a deep movie.
There's two things specifically and they're going to be quick.
Sure.
Okay. Sam, do you have anything else before we get to those?
Things you'd like for us to not?
I think that if we took the natural progression of where we were talking about with Remy's dad, we'd end up talking about Remy, where he goes and kind of his whole dealing with his own, what's the word? His own,
hairline.
Hairline? Is that what you said?
I was just trying to guess.
No. His his own duality, his own, he's hypocritical.
Okay.
Of himself. He insists that he insists that he doesn't want to be a rat, and he insists that he wants to see something more in the world. He wants to be the change in the world. He insists all these high things, and then he turns around and is a thief in the right circumstances, and he exactly goes right back to his roots that he insists when he's talking to his dad, I am not that, and then he turns around and does that immediately.
And another example of his duality, right, is he loves the everyone can cook because that means that he can cook.
Yeah.
But then when he's looking at the restaurant
and
Gusto says, who's that? And he says, oh, he's nobody. He's probably the plongeur or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? He washes tables, takes out the garbage. And so he immediately discounts Linguini because not a cook.
He's not handling the food.
And then his figment of his imagination of Gusto is like, well, anybody can cook. He's like, not that guy.
Yeah.
Anybody can cook, but not anybody should cook, right? So he's got that duality within himself of even like his most fundamental core belief.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is. And eventually he ends up having to come to terms with Linguini's part because like one of the quotes that I wrote down, which is one of the just very straightforward lines, is a classic Linguini line.
Classic
Linguini line.
Man.
Is he just says, like, you know how to cook. And I know how to appear human. And that's about all he brings to the table. And
that's what I bring to the table.
The reason why that, ultimately though, even though that line is so stupid and so funny, that's really the crux of their conflict in that movie.
Yeah.
is that Remy wants to be a human, and he keeps butting up to the wall that says, no, you're a rat, and you have to realize what you are. Really, yeah. Remy's arc makes a turn when he has to face that reality so much. Yeah, he has to learn to accept who he is and learn how to work with that.
Yeah.
And work with the strengths that Linguini has, which is that Linguini is actually a great mediator. He's constantly cutting in between people. He's constantly talking to this person and talking to this person. He's constantly the guy in between.
Yeah.
And Remy has to come to terms with the fact that he needs Linguini to be his guy in between,
right,
in order to make his passion a reality. So he has to learn how to humble himself and not stand up on his high horse and put value in the plongeur.
Yeah.
So,
Jeff, anything else?
I've just got two quick things. They won't take long. Nelson, what's the first one?
So the first one is a speech from Colette to Linguini. Mm-hmm. How many women do you see in this kitchen? Only me. Why do you think that is? Because haute cuisine is an antiquated hierarchy built upon rules written by stupid old men. Rules designed to make it impossible for women to enter this world. But still, I'm here. How did this happen? Because I'm the toughest cook in this kitchen. I've worked too hard for too long to get here, and I'm not going to jeopardize it for some garbage boy who got lucky. Got it? Mm. And it's true, when you look at like high-end cuisine, you see very few women. And largely because of how regimented those environments are. It's not that it's hostile to women, it's that women don't thrive in those environments. Mm-hmm. It used to be that it was hostile to women. Mm-hmm. Meryl Streep did a movie, Julie and Julia, which is about a woman who cooked her way through Julia Child's cookbook while also giving flashbacks of Julia Child learning to be a chef. And
that was my Julia Child impression.
Oh, was it? I thought you were doing today, like Goofy slash Ghost.
That's my Julia Child.
It was okay.
She learned to be a chef in France, and she faced a lot of difficulty simply because she was a woman trying to do high-end cuisine.
Yeah.
But ultimately, she thrived and outshadowed the majority of the men that she worked of her contemporaries. So I like Colette here. But it also reminded me not just of the movie Julie and Julia with Meryl Streep, but also of a gaffe that Burger King had in the UK. For International Women's Day a few years ago, they ran an ad that said, "Women belong in the kitchen." What they were trying to point out was that despite the fact that women are just as competent of cooks, there's very few of them in the kitchen.
So that's where the ad ended.
It
wasn't like no a context
and then a correction. It was just women belong in the kitchen.
That was their Women's Day, International Women's Day.
Oh my gosh.
This was like 2021, and it's one of my favorite marketing gaffes.
That's amazing.
Because they were trying to be so progressive.
The intention was and pure.
They were trying to be so progressive, and it just sounds antiquated. And the funny thing is, like in high cuisine, even though, you know, traditionally women are the cooks, when you get into high-level cuisine, traditionally women are not in those positions.
Mm. All right. And I've got one more thing. What you got, Nelson?
The other thing that you have is one of my favorite interactions that I've seen in a movie where people give each other advice. Mm-hmm. And it's between Colette and Linguini. Linguini says, "Thank you for all the advice about cooking."
Yeah.
And she says, "Thank you too." And he says, "For what?" And she says, "For taking it."
Yeah. I had that one written down too.
Yeah. Because the amount of times where like you give somebody advice and they're just like, you know, pearls before swine. And it's frustrating. Yeah. And it is so, so nice when you give somebody advice and they take it. And all the advice she gives is excellent advice.
As a swine, I don't understand the idea of pearls, so that's on them for throwing pearls at me. I don't need pearls. It is nice to be acknowledged when like I'm extending a hand.
Yeah. Just one thing that makes a really, really good chef is to be teachable.
Yes.
Like,
that's applicable in any field.
Like, just do not pretend you are the highest, that you are like the highest one in the kitchen. Right. You always have to be willing to be cut down because you have to always be willing to learn, to continue to learn.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you become Chef Skinner, who's just run by fear because he's afraid of losing.
Who finds out that he might be losing his star.
Yeah. Yeah. And he spends the entire time. I thought it was funny the fact that he was the only one who ever saw Remy and who was ever haunted by this by this image of a rat in his kitchen. Yep. And that was firstly because he saw Linguini come in and he called Linguini the rat. And he's convinced because he suddenly is succeeding that this person taking away his power is the rat in his kitchen. So now he's haunted.
Oh, it's by a metaphor. A rat.
Yeah. So now he's haunted by a rat in his kitchen, and he's spending the whole time trying to kill Remy and trying to take the rat out because his power is being undermined because he can't sell frozen foods and make all the money in the world without doing a lick of work. He's run by fear.
And the word rat is in Ratatouille.
Indeed. Indeed. And
guys,
and if you remember at the very beginning, one of the first things that Gusteau said through the TV to Remy was his full quote was, great cooking is not for the faint of heart. You must be imaginative, strong-hearted. You must try things that may not work, and you must not let anyone define your limits because of where you come from.
That's right.
Your only limit is your soul. What I say is true. Anyone can cook, but only the fearless can be great. And ultimately, I think that's one of the big truth claims that this one makes, is that in order to find greatness, in order to move from where you are, which might be extremely lower class, just eating garbage, in order to move upward or move forward, to follow your dreams and follow your passions, you have to learn to be fearless.
Yeah.
And constantly, you're constantly seeing everybody in this story having to face fear in one way or another, from one angle or another, whether it's Jeff Skinner, who can't get over it, whether it's his father, who's living in survival mode and can't seem to bridge the gap between him and Remy and help him to be fearless and follow his dreams, or whether it's Colette, who's very much a terrifying person, but understands the art of it. Mm-hmm. Or Linguini, who can't do a thing and is out of place the whole time and is terrified of everybody. Or Ego, who just exudes fear.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very constant theme, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
From the culinary side of things, the advice that Colette gives is terrific advice, right? Like, he's slowly cutting celery. Mm-hmm. And the pot is on the table. She moves it so that the pot is like the top of the pot is level with the table. She chops quickly. So it's efficient use of space, efficient use of time.
Yeah.
Right. Then she talks about how clean stations is everything, and like clean sleeves and dirty aprons is a sign of a good chef. Fresh ingredients. Right. So like they're and the one that I loved, because I think it's true, but I want your opinion as a bread baker.
Yeah.
The sound of bread is the quality of bread. Do you agree?
Yes.
Yeah, it's so spot on.
The sound of just fresh bread, just like the crunch, it's great. Like that sound bite they used for that bread is
perfect.
There's beautiful. There's a scene in Good Burger where the villain in the first Good Burger asks, how's $20 sound? And Kel goes,
crunch?
And he's like, I thought of that then when I watched when they said that line, and I thought of it now when we were talking about
it's beautiful.
It's just a beautiful moment. I don't know, I'm dumb. Like, it's a great movie. I had one squeamish moment in this movie that I thought about as you guys were talking just now.
Was it when he grabs the rat underneath the thing and its eyes pop out?
It's earlier at the beginning. It's earlier on when Remy's trying to get out of his first time in the kitchen. He's trying to escape.
Yeah.
He falls in with the onions and the carrots.
Oh, yeah. Almost gets put in the oven.
And I'm just like, it was just that there was a rat with onions and carrots.
Yeah.
It was that moment. It wasn't even him almost getting baked. It was just, there's a rat in the onions and the carrots. Yeah,
the movie's real gross in some ways.
That's true.
It is a very gross movie when you just think about the hygiene. And Remy does clean his hands with one drop of water. Yeah, he's fine. You know. But and he chooses to walk on two legs because of hygiene. He talks about it.
Yeah.
All right, let's wrap this up.
Do you have wrap-up questions?
I do. Thank you for asking. Oh, man.
What a lead-up.
Do you guys want them?
Yep.
Would you guys recommend this movie?
I would.
No.
Is it strictly because of the rats?
Because of the rats. Of the rats. I also think Chef is a better food movie. I think the menu explores high cuisine better. I think The Bear does a better job than the menu. But if you want a contained story,
that's a good point. Menu.
Okay. What about just the entertainment value, Nelson? And your personal, like, if you're able to put your rap bias aside,
I can.
Just as an entertainment, can this movie entertain and get the job done for their audience? He's trying really hard. I'm so proud of you, Nelson. Yeah. Like,
I don't like this movie.
Okay.
And it's just because
that's fair.
Of the rats.
I allow it.
Okay. I think that I think that I would recommend this movie if somebody just wants just a fun movie to watch.
It's like if you're an arachnophobic and you're like, would you recommend Eight-Legged Freaks? Yeah. Like, that's what this movie is for me. It's my favorite thing and my least favorite thing matched together in an unholy matrimony. I'm not going to recommend it.
Right.
That's fair. Is there an actual phobia name?
There is.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a phobia for everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I would definitely recommend this. I think this is one of... This is only the This is only the second time that Pixar's done a movie that's not American. Now, granted, they've got some alien movies.
That's not located in
North America. Luca is Italy, but it's not food based. It's not food. Now, the one guy does make a lot of pasta, but I think this movie that's Mexico.
I guess it's the Americas.
No, it's Mexico. Yeah. No, you're right. Coco is Mexico. Mm-hmm. I appreciated just the international flair of this film.
Yeah.
Like, as someone who doesn't have a rap bias, it didn't bother me. I thought it was a nice taste of France. Like, and it was a taste from a different perspective of France. Like, it was cool to, I appreciated just that international flair. I thought all the characters were great. I thought I love the music. It was that French.
It's really fun.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, the sound of it.
It was French. It was French. It was the soundtrack was French. There we go. I appreciate it. I enjoyed this film. Is it my favorite? No. I think there's better movies that depict food better.
Yeah.
But I was
depends on what you're trying to go for. Like, if you're trying to go for realism in the kitchen, then probably going to want to go for one of those other ones. But if you're just going to go for fun, fun with food.
Was entertained. And I enjoyed it. So I would recommend this to anyone. It was a fun film. This movie is rated G. We talked about this already. Would you guys change the rating?
I would have expected it to be PG, but I think G is fine.
I have the same opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't, there's nothing in this that can't be seen by someone of a young age.
Yeah.
I agree. 2007, has this movie aged well?
There were a couple moments where I was like, oh, they would have animated that differently now.
Oh.
But Pixar is so ahead of its time every time with their animation styles. So I think it's aged great.
Like, I've noticed going back to Toy Story 1.
Sure.
That this
But then
this
you compare Toy Story 1 with other animation of its day and it's light years ahead.
Yeah. Light years.
Ha ha ha. Ha ha ha.
I don't think that was intentional.
That was two puns so far that I've done completely unintentionally.
That's amazing. I would say it's aged well. I think CG in general doesn't hold up once new CG is presented.
That's true.
But
Pixar is the exception.
Yeah.
Pixar is the exception that the movie's still good, but you can tell a difference in quality.
Yeah. From then to now, but I think that in the day it was made. Taking that into consideration, I think that the CG is awesome.
That's the question, though.
Comparing the CG then to the CG now, of course, it's come leaps and bounds.
Right.
I mean, the moment when they were both fried by the lightning strike and, their fur was sticking up all over the place, I remember that as being, looking...
Incredible.
Looking really, really incredible. And then now looking back, I'm like, oh okay.
A weaker part of the movie for animation. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I agree. I think it's aged well. Looking at the kind of topics that I think would be focused on now, if they made this movie now, the topics that are focused on in the movie are very different. So in that way, it's not the same kind of movie that they would make if they were to make it again.
Sure.
So in that way, I mean, you could, whether that means it hasn't aged well, I think I personally think that it's aged well because I think that the messages they're trying to share are timeless. So I think it aged well, but that depends on kind of what metric you're looking for.
That's right. I think it's, and this movie doesn't necessarily have a time period either. Like, it's kind of hard to place the time era of the film, the setting, but it even watching it in 2024, I like it. Yeah. I think it's aged
good.
Yeah. Would this movie be in your personal top 250? Nelson, number one?
I think I gave this 3 out of 5. And so it might shake out that way, but no.
And you won't watch this movie again.
If I can avoid it.
If you don't, it's not required by the podcast or something else, you won't watch this again.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sam? Since my list of movies that I watch on the regular is so small, I'm going to say yes, because it is one of the few that I will go back to and thoroughly enjoy.
Okay, cool. I think this movie would probably shake out to be in the top 250. It's definitely not in my top hierarchy, mm-hmm. but it's in my scale is based on rewatchability. And so when I place my movie on my rank, I go, would I watch this again? Would I watch this before this one?
Yeah.
And I gave it a 7.5 and I'm fluctuating my rankings as we add more films and stuff. Like, I think this one would probably be in the 200s for my top 250.
Yeah.
As it shakes out.
Like, listen, Pixar knocks it out of the park for animation.
I agree.
Excellent storytelling.
Yeah.
Incredible character arcs.
Yeah.
But I there's high cuisine movies I'd rather watch, and that's fair. They don't involve rats.
That's fair.
any of the food movies you've mentioned,
none of them have rats.
Would any of those make your top 250 as far as films in general?
Yeah, Chef definitely would.
Okay,
The Menu might. The Bear is among my favorite TV
that's
shows.
It's not a movie; it doesn't count.
Yeah, I know, but long form storytelling.
I know, I got you. Cool. Yeah. I just didn't know if like food in general had a place on your top 250.
I saw Julie and Julia when it came out, but I don't remember.
Do you remember it being fun? Like, do you remember?
I remember enjoying
entertained
it.
By, another one I thought of.
Meryl Streep's
phenomenal. I can't remember the characters, the actors and the actresses. I want to say it's a rom com, but it's more rom than com.
Mm-hmm. Spanglish.
No Reservation.
Oh yeah, that's based on Anthony Bourdain's book. It's Bradley Cooper stars in it, and they did a spinoff TV show as well.
Hold on, because I'm not picturing. Oddly enough, No Reservation came out in 2007. Let's continue here. It's Aaron Eckhart.
So Bradley Cooper did a movie and a TV show inspired by Anthony Bourdain stuff, and I thought
let's look that up. Burnt. 2015. Bradley Cooper. So yeah, I've not seen Burnt.
And Spanglish is another.
Is that a food movie?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that was a food.
Adam Sandler is a chef. And his wife is Taya Leone, and then they have a Spanish housemaid that becomes a tryst of sorts. I remember thinking it was an interesting movie.
Is it a comedy? It's Adam Sandler, is it?
It's a rom-com, but more drama than comedy. Okay. It's like a rom-drama.
Rom-com.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
But still wouldn't be in like the... Yeah, I'd still recommend The Menu and Chef and The Bear.
And we've talked about Chef multiple times.
Yeah.
The reason when you first mentioned Chef's Table, I first thought you were talking about... There's another show on Netflix called Chef. And it's a TV series that Jon Favreau came up with while he was doing it's the concept. So he interviews chefs and he talks with, he has celebrities and they cook around the table. It's unscripted,
okay,
yeah. but he talks, and a lot of times it's people that were connected with the film that he made.
Yeah.
But there's a multiple episode series called Chef.
Yeah.
And it's also Jon Favreau. And that's why I thought you were mentioning it first. But yes, I've heard of Chef's Table as well. Completely different.
No, I grew up watching a lot of Food Network and like foodie type stuff. And and I love really high-end cuisine. It's not in my price range, but it's in my... like competency. Like, I can cook better than I can eat most places. That doesn't stop me
from eating. You look better than you smell.
Well, I look more like what Linguini says about Anton Ego, which is, you don't look like somebody that likes good food. You're rather skinny for somebody that likes good food. I take more after what my father always told me, which is, never trust a skinny chef.
And with that,
last question, guys. Why do you think this is on the top 250?
Beats me. I don't know. Doesn't make sense to me. It's got rats in it, Jeff. Why would you want to watch a movie with rats in it?
Sam.
I think it's on the top 250 because there are many layers to it. There are many arcs going on.
Like onions.
Yeah, like onions. Funny enough.
Or parfaits.
It's true. Or ogres. But that's...
Oh, yeah, they've got layers.
That's another story. But yeah, I think that this story has a lot going for it, a lot of potential ways you can look at it, a lot of messages that it's sharing. And I think that that's why it's ended up here, is because the concept and the plots and the overall story that it's telling is a timeless story of overcoming fear and discovering who you are and learning how to live in that with confidence.
That's a great answer. My answer...
Probably the rats. That's why it's there.
Yeah. No, I'm just a big rat guy.
You got to even the scale somehow.
For me, I think you get... I didn't think about this question up until this moment. This movie, okay, so we have five senses.
Sure.
Sixth, if you're
We actually have Bruce Willis. 20 senses, by the way.
Okay. Well, actually, just
but like food movies, and it's so it's not just Ratatouille, but food movies utilizes more of all five of our senses, even though we can't smell.
Smell-o-vision.
Like, but like
it tries to find every way possible.
When we see things on TV, like, and this could be the news, this could be anything. Yeah. When we see something, it does remind us of smells.
Yeah,
so even I did if we're like not when smelling, they closed their eyes and there was the
they
music.
Visualize. Yeah.
Yeah, that was great.
It's so like I like movies that help that make me tap into more parts of my humanity.
Yeah.
And also when they're done well. And this movie did that well. I could smell, and again, spending time in a sort of a kitchen, like I can, the sound of knives cutting vegetables, like that was that was a visceral moment.
The Foley work in this movie is phenomenal.
Yeah. The it's imagery like, of like the steam coming off of everything. Yeah. Like, it's just, it's beautiful.
I've never worked in a kitchen like this, but like the when Linguini had that drunken stupor with Skinner, and then that he's like, okay, you got to clean up everything, and he just he's looking at this kitchen that's a mess.
Like
I've seen kitchens like that.
I felt so bad for him in like, that moment. I was like, oh, I know that feeling.
There was moments where I felt seen, and there was moments where I'm like, go get him. Like it's like it just like. I think this movie taps into all of your senses as a human, because we eat, we see food, we smell food, we hold food, we want to survive. This movie talks about survival.
Yeah.
This movie talks about the finer things. Like it's all of our senses of human, being a human. And I think it does it in a great way. Maybe it's not the best to ever do it, but it does it in a great way. And I love
On
rats.
The other hand, though.
Rats.
There's rats.
So I think this movie tells this story very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I know that you like the movie Chef.
Mm-hmm. I do like the movie Chef.
Between the two, which would you recommend?
If someone was asking,
should I watch Chef or Ratatouille?
I would go Chef for one reason.
Mm-hmm. It's a better movie, and there's not rats in it.
It's not,
that's two reasons.
It's not the food. It's not the food portion. The thing that, so I've seen Chef once, and I remember Lindsay and I going, this was a great movie.
Yeah, I've seen it a few times. I love it.
For me, it was the family moments.
Mm-hmm.
The building of the food truck.
Yeah.
The interrelational like stuff that's happening with his family while the truck stuff's going on. Like, like those heartwarming humanity moments.
Yeah.
Those are the moments I'm going, oh, wow, this movie's got me. The food part for me was second when it came to Chef. So if someone asked what's a better food movie?
Yeah.
I may actually refer to Ratatouille, because for me, I think the food was the primary source of this movie. For me, Chef was humans doing food things.
Okay.
But I thought Chef
is probably more grounded in like the real world and the real version of food.
Yeah.
Like there's a scene in Chef where he makes a grilled cheese sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
I love that moment. I love it.
And they consulted with real chefs, and they shot that several times. Yep. That's actually Jon Favreau doing it. And like that's a damn good grilled cheese sandwich, I gotta say.
Yeah. So I feel like depending on who's asking the question, I would say a different answer.
Okay.
But like I love Chef. I need to rewatch that one here. Maybe suggest it for the top 250 if you guys are listening.
Top 250 idea.
And maybe we'll have you back, Sam, for that as well.
If you end up doing that one, I'd be happy to come back for that one.
But yeah, this was a great episode. Great conversation. Sam, thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
Before we close out this episode, Sam, is there anything you'd like to plug? Is there anything that if the audience would like to find you some way, do you have any social medias? Or if not, that's fine. But is there any way people can find you?
I really don't post all that much. But the only thing I really have is an Instagram account. Otherwise, I don't really do much online with at Silly Samuel.
Oh.
S-A-M-M-U-L.
Okay.
Samuel.
You don't want to.
Silly Samuel.
You don't want to.
Hefe. What are we doing next week?
Probably talking about a movie.
Do you know what movie?
I do.
Sam, do you know what movie?
No.
Oh, all right. Well, Cool Hand Luke.
Could you
Luke.
Take a guess? Cool Hand Luke, 19...
Have you seen it?
67. I've seen Cool Hands on a guy named Luke, but I know nothing about this movie. I got it up right now on IMDb. It's Paul Newman.
Is this movie about hand bottles?
I thought it was Clint Eastwood.
It could be both, but this...
I assumed this was Clint Eastwood.
Paul Newman. A laid-back Southern man is sentenced to 2 years in a rural prison,
can you do that
but
in a Southern
refuses
accent?
To conform.
A laid back Southern man.
I can't talk Southern without putting like a country riff behind it.
Usually, when I try to do Southern, man. I just end up being a plantation owner.
Hate when that happens.
Yeah. All right, Cool Hand Luke. Never seen it. Don't know anything about it. It's Newman,
Wayne Rogers,
the salad sauce guy, salad dressings.
Wayne Rogers. I know that name, so I'm going to do some studying on that.
Well,
no, you're thinking of Randy Newman.
Yeah.
Randy Newman's the salad guy.
No,
and also the piano guy. It's the same name.
It's the same Newman?
It's different guy, same name.
Oh.
Sure, people got no reason.
It's Randy Newman's. It's new. Well, it's Newman's Own. Newman's Own dressing is the dressing.
Yeah.
It's Newman's Own. But maybe, I don't know, I guess maybe I don't know the first name of the Newman's Own.
Well, we'll have that straightened out for next week.
We will figure that out. Sam, thank you so much for being on.
Absolutely.
We hope you had a great time. We were okay with you being on.
Yeah, no, that's good.
We'll probably have you back.
Love to have you back. That'd be great.
Good to be here.
And scene.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did.
If you found value in what we discussed today, please consider leaving us a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.
If you have any feedback or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you.
That's right. Tell us why we're wrong.
If you want even more content and ways to engage with us and each other, check out our Patreon page.
By supporting us there, you'll get access to exclusive bonus content and help us continue to create high-quality episodes, as well as help pay for our future plans. Links to our social media, merchandise, and Patreon are in the show notes.